Good afternoon and welcome to Radio Astina for today, Tuesday, September 2nd, 2008. This is our 23rd show. All of them are archived within 24 hours, available at vnnforum.com. Look under the broadcasting section again, Radio Astina. Astina is the opposite of the Russian word Pravda, which you may remember from back in the old days. Pravda being the ideological truth or the big lie, and Astina being the opposite in Russia, the antonym, the street-level reality, the factual truth. And that's what I'm here to bring you today. This show is probably not going to be as long as others, but we're going to go through a good long story of Leo Frank and show you how whites have changed over the last 100 years. And they've gone from lynching guilty Jews, bringing justice to them, to sitting back and watching football, doing nothing while their nation's destroyed. And excuse me. On that front, I want to begin by talking about four commercials and just sort of the atmosphere they portray today, and then we'll get into Leo Frank, which is written about in two long articles in Culture Wars from April and May of this year, and it goes nicely with the Marcus Garvey we talked about in the last couple of shows, 21 and 22. But anyway, what you may or may not realize is that TV is a mass medium controlled by Jews and used to condition whites in a number of ways, such that the only valid role for an adult white male is essentially watching niggers play some kind of sports, or listening to his wife, or being played for an idiot by his kids. Weak, wimpy, passive, never strong. The only place on TV where whites are ever depicted as strong, capable white men, rather than the dismissive white male used by Jews and feminists, is in army commercials, where they're trying to attract fodder. So you are only legitimated by TV as a white man when you are serving Israel, either abroad, going abroad to Iraq or Iran to fight and die for Israel, or when you're serving their domestic agenda by allowing your daughter to mix with muds, or passively using your off hours to watch nigger ball from the couch while being dominated by your wife. This is the role that they have reserved for whites who created this country that the Jews and the Third World are now destroying. And it's not simply the content of these shows and these movies that Jews create out of Hollywood with their 1001 production companies that depict white males as weak or evil. It's the advertising as well, created by Jews, fags, and feminists. And I couldn't help but note, this weekend was the opening week of football, which is the number one spectator sport in America. And what the viewer would have seen are various ads showing whites as ridiculous. And I wrote down a couple of them. One is Embassy Suites, and these are kind of examples of just what's seen as normal today by the corporate interests that are largely controlled by Jews, the larger ones, the Fortune 500, the famous ones. And they run ads made by Jewish ad makers, and they push a Jew agenda. And so, any kind of non-material goal runs in opposition to what corporations are after. They're about profit. Therefore, there's always a standing inducement, a monetary inducement, to put race aside and focus on what will bring the biggest return. And for many of these industries, having safe, solvent, responsible people who subordinate money to, say, honor, runs against the interests of the large corporations as well as the Jews. And when the Jews take power in a country, as they have in the United States over the course of the 20th century, why every last possible incentive to act honorably or rationally or merely even legally is removed. Or there's a legal stick in the way if they were to try to uphold any non-material value. So all of this working together, the Jews and the corporate interests, puts us in a situation where nobody can look out for what's genuinely good for Americans, and white people founded American, and non-whites are not Americans. In case you think I was using that term inclusively, no. America was founded by whites. Whites came to America first. They were called the Solutrians. They came here 17,000 years ago. There's plenty of fossil documentary evidence of that. Even though the government tries to swamp it, I was rereading about that again last night in the case of Kennewick Man. What you have are all these skulls, and an anthropologist can recognize racial differences from looking at skulls alone. So different are the three races. So many of these skulls have been found, or these bones and other stone evidence has been found across the western U.S. where it's better preserved because of it's drier out there and the soil is different. So much of this has been found suggesting that Europeans were here long before the Siberian invasion of Asians, that the government in league with the Indians has rushed to cover it all up. And they don't want you to know the truth about what was going on back then. Instead, they prefer a deracinated mass, a hodgepodge, a multicultural cesspool of flotsam and jetsam from the seven sewers of the world. And this is what they depict in their commercials, which are meant to condition you and show you acting in an appropriate way. All the words the middle class loves, appropriate, responsible, tasteful. All these are defined as acting the way that the corporate bosses and the Jews controlling the larger agenda wish, rather than in the way that's actually good for whites and preserves the nation, as we're going to learn about in the Leo Frank case. Leo Frank being a Jew, and in the odd case you're not aware who Leo Frank was, he was a Jew who ran a factory down in Atlanta. He molested, raped, and murdered a white girl, and then the Jews up in New York, using their money and their media power, tried to pervert justice and buy him off. But instead, the people of Atlanta and people of Georgia rose up and hanged him rather than allow justice to be denied in the case of Mary Fagan, who he raped and murdered. And this, the anger at this justice brought to one of their criminals, it so angered the Jews that they created the American Jewish Committee and the Anti-Defamation League to protect their own, because by their gangster code, non-Jews are animals and may be disposed with any way the Jews see fit, including rape and murder. And the dirty, hated goyim, the stupid cattle, the unclean beast that they call us, have no right to resent their own being raped and murdered by God's chosen people, as they nominate themselves. So today, rather, when the white man flips on the TV, he sees an Embassy Suites ad in which a white guy is a goofball, and his white boss can't send him anywhere because he always answers questions with questions, which is actually, that's a legal technique associated with Jews, always answering one question with another question. But of course here it's attributed to a white who's an off-putting goofball, so the white female manager has to send the black on the road to represent the corporation, because blacks are responsible, respectable, and friendly like that. Blacks don't cause social problems. There's another ad I'm not even going to talk about. There's a series from Progressive that have the noble black Morgan Freeman, Samuel Jackson type, intoning honorably as the responsible adult, while the white goofballs are dressed in dresses pretending to be cheerleaders to sneak into a stadium to see their favorite band of niggers, you know, their professional sports team. This is, again, common. Blacks portrayed as responsible. Everything racial is inverted, flipped in its head. Whites aren't the responsible, creative, adult people. Niggers are in TV world. TV world is a product of the Jews. second example, besides the Embassy Suites and the Progressive. Well, Progressive I just threw in there because it occurred to me. I had four I was going to discuss, but second would be FreeCreditReport.com. Now, they have a series of commercials, a white band singing about how they should check their credit scores. Well, in the latest one, it's essentially like a redone rap video, and they've assumed the places of the rap niggers, and then they're all embarrassed and quickly jumping out of the way when the rightful niggers show up with blondes on their arms to claim their limos and their jacuzzi and their grills back. If you've ever seen a BET rap video, they almost all feature that kind of garbage to the extent they have anything outside of a club where the niggers are drinking champagne. Having gotten rich or died trying. Anyway, you know, whites portrayed as basically losers, submissives, and passives, always on TV. The only other role they have is to serve as evil. And you know for sure that evil is always represented as a white man with blonde hair in Jewish movies. And the heroes are always knobby little dark-eyed, dark-haired Jews, like Adam Sandler. So, Embassy Suites, FreeCreditReport.com. Third example would be a Samsung ad. And this shows a father and his kid, and he starts talking about a rite of passage. You know, these are both blue-eyed, average Nordic white people. And the rite of passage is him giving his kid some goofy Viking horns to wear as they settle in to watch niggers on TV, watch pro football. And that's what manhood means in 2008 in America, watching niggers on TV. That's the socially acceptable role for any kind of aggressive outlet that a white male might have, a white man. He can only be a man when he's spectating or obeying his woman or going abroad to fight for Israel. Those are three of very few legitimate outlets for white masculinity. But basically, the white man's job is to serve as the butt bearing the burden. He is to make the money and turn it over to the woman and the kids without questioning. And he is to assume all historical guilt, and he is to stand aside as his country is browned out through the influx of third worlders since the Jews have taken over his government, and he dare not fight back against it and preserve his own living space. His kind are to be driven out and driven under. That's his job, to accept that. Because the Jews define what's America. They speak for America. They set its agenda. They tell us who we are and what we're allowed to tell our kids that we are until we say otherwise. Finally, the most egregious new commercial of all of the new set that are being shown, and they're being shown 50 times a day. If you watch a football game, you'll see them shown over and over and over. The final one is a race mixing commercial by Levi's. Now, I happen to know someone who used to work at Levi's, and the people who buy their jeans are they did their best. If you remember the Bruce Willis years when he was his hottest, and his demographic, you know, whites who are 20 to 40 were the main consumers, but Levi wants to remake itself as hip and appeal to urban youth, as they often say. And the way it does that is by endless hip-hop spots. Well, the latest spot shows some nigger getting up. He's obviously just fucked this white girl who's lying there asleep. And he's leaving, and some old nigger is strumming on a guitar, talking about, should he wake her up? Should he do this? Should he do that? Some things are better left unsaid or unbuttoned, so their new campaign is something like Life Unbuttoned, and it has all these sexual situations, being very cool and edgy, featuring nigs and whites who aren't buttoning their jeans all the way. And this is Levi's attempt to make itself cool enough to regain whatever other market share it's lost, these other jeans. And yet again, the depiction of how of white females with black males, because after all, they're more masculine, they're better at sports, they're better at music. Whites are just losers. And all this stuff is reinforced if you ever watch the comedy on Comedy Central. Whenever they have white comedians, almost every white comedian, as the price of being put on Comedy Central, or having their own show done up on HBO. They have to have included in their bits, as comedians break it down, they have to have at least one segment where they're promoting either white guilt or black superiority at something, whether it's at athletics or white guilt for slavery. There's always an element of that anytime you have a white male non-Jew comedian. And it's kind of the equivalent to the white female, that whenever white females get TV exposure, they always have to either have a mud boyfriend or be placating slash attracted to non-white males as a way to get their in card into the accepted crowd of actors. So this is the context that whites are in today. They are encouraged and conditioned by TV and schools to, in general, be dumber than before, because they've been dumbed down through the teaching of inferior techniques, techniques that work against reading. And they've been encouraged to have the right attitudes, and they've been encouraged to turn to experts. So never ever to trust themselves, to make up their own mind, or be decisive. All these are bad things, according to the government and the Jew-controlled media. And in their media, they depict whites the way they'd like to see them, as utterly passive, spectating, assimilated to non-white values, the values of the muds and the kikes. These are bad things, I think I hardly need to tell you. Now, with that having said, that's where the males are today. Many people live for football and they live for sports, and that's all they really care about, and that's the only legitimated thing for white males in this society, besides working and paying the 50% taxes deducted from their paycheck. Now we want to talk about how it used to be in the olden days, and it was pretty much this time of year also, in the end of the summer, heading towards fall. Whites back then weren't so concerned about football, which barely existed and wasn't on a national level. They were worried about justice for their own. And E. Michael Jones, who we've talked about many times before as the man behind CultureWars.com, the magazine, and a couple of the books, Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control, and The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, his latest 1,000-page tome. A couple of those two are giant tomes we've discussed at length and will continue to discuss. Well, in his magazine, in the April and May 2008 issues, he discusses at length the Leo Frank trial, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, some of you who may have heard of Dr. William Pierce, he also covered this, and although he might have had a slightly different interpretation, he had the same basic interpretation as E. Michael Jones does, or I should put that the other way. E. Michael Jones has the same basic interpretation as William Pierce, and that's because although one is a traditional Catholic and the other a white nationalist, they both begin with the facts. And the fact is undeniable that this Jew did rape and murder this white girl, Mary Fagan. The Jew's name was Leo Frank. So, E. Michael Jones calls his article in the April issue, he calls it Carry the War into Africa. And we'll find out where that phrase comes from as we move along. The Leo Frank trial. He says, on April 26, 1913, remember, we talked about Marcus Garvey and the undermining of black nationalism and the Back to Africa movement on the last couple of Radio Estinas. So the point here is, this stuff with Leo Frank is taking place at the same time, and Jews are realizing, as a result of Frank being hanged by the angry populace, that they can't get away with raping and murdering whites. They're going to have to take over more media, bribe more people, and condition whites better so that their Jews can get away with molesting and doing whatever the heck they want. Otherwise, they run the risk of being brought to justice. So, at the same time they're realizing this, they're also attacking Marcus Garvey in the first two decades of the 20th century, because Marcus Garvey is advocating something that's actually good for blacks, which is going back to Africa, whereas the Jew needs the black in America to destroy whites, not least the white South. So remember, most of the black population at this time is located in the South. the black belt from Texas all the way over to South Carolina. So on April 26, 1913, and all this plays itself out over a couple of years, 1913 to 1915, Mary Fagan was found dead in the basement of the National Pencil Factory in Atlanta, Georgia. Mary Fagan was a pretty, busty 14-year-old pencil factory employee and the object of unwanted attention from the factory manager, Leo Frank, head of the local B'nai B'rith Lodge, B'nai B'rith meaning Brothers of the Cut, referring to Jews. So you've got a Jew owns a factory, and in this factory is employed a young, attractive white female, and the Jew is hitting on her and molesting her and eventually raping and murdering her. Says Jones, eventually Frank was indicted for her murder. At the time of the Leo Frank case, there was next to no anti-Semitism in the South. Jews were perceived as a people of the book. Up until the time of the Leo Frank case, the most famous instance of anti-Semitism in the South was perpetrated by a Yankee. And I know some of you from VNNForum.com, which we encourage you all to join, will be familiar with this. On December 17, 1862, in the middle of the Civil War, General Ulysses S. Grant, writing from his headquarters in Holly Springs, Mississippi, announced that the Jews as a class, and this is a quote, the Jews as a class, violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also departmental order, are hereby expelled from the department within 24 hours from the receipt of this order. So the Treasury Department is setting up orders and the Jews are violating them all. So he expels them. The North could hardly accuse the South, says Jones, of anti-Semitism because no official in the North had a rank as high as the one which Judah P. Benjamin, Jefferson Davis's right-hand man, held during the period of the Confederacy. After the war, Jewish peddlers made their way down South. But, in spite of their often sharp business practices, there weren't enough of them to provoke anti-Semitism. Besides, when it came to racial issues, the South had other more pressing problems. Racial prejudice in the South was a black and white issue. The Frank trial took place at a time when the South's redemption from Reconstruction was an accomplished fact. So Jones is saying you had the Civil War, you had Reconstruction, you had the rise of the Klan to fight back against what the Northern whites were trying to do to racially despoil the South by placing Negroes as governors and senators, giving them the run of the place. Niggers did what they always do, rape and murder, and the Ku Klux Klan arose against that. And Jones is saying by this time of the Leo Frank case in the 1910 to 1915, the South had pretty much redeemed itself. Maybe not economically, it was still worse off than it had been, but politically it had redeemed itself and fashioned the segregation laws that would allow the whites to live civilized lives, even though the blacks were always looming there as potential monsters. So Jones says the Frank trial took place at a time when the South's redemption from Reconstruction was an accomplished fact. Lynching was, if anything, on the wane in 1913, and the citizens of the state of Georgia were eager to prove their allegiance to the rule of law. In this regard, most Georgians viewed the Frank proceedings with a sense of pride, as showing how far they had come from their recent troubled past. In spite of the volatile material at the heart of the case, the rape and the murder of a 14-year-old girl, no one had been lynched. Not even the Negro watchman Jim Connelly, C-O-N-L-E-Y, the Negro watchman at the pencil factory, Jim Connelly, before the case went to trial. If anything, the Frank trial showed the lack of prejudice when it indicted Frank, the Jew, over the pencil company's Negro watchman, Jim Connelly. Once the trial began, Leo Frank's character, specifically his sexual morals, became the central issue. Female employees testified that Frank often entered their dressing room and favored them with unwanted attention that included kissing and fondling. So this Jew is the poster kike for sexual harassment of the kind Jews would outlaw even in much milder forms after their communist revolution in the 1960s. But Leo Frank shows what they're actually like themselves. A newspaper boy who was a friend of Mary Fagan, P-H-A-G-A-N, testified that she had been pursued by Frank and was afraid to be alone with him, as she was on the last day of her life when she went to his office to pick up her paycheck. On that Saturday in April, the city of Atlanta was preparing for a parade commemorating its Civil War veterans, and the pencil factory's office was empty except for Jew Frank and Fagan, a fact Jew Frank would have known when he told Fagan to come in and pick up her pay. Fagan's salary for a week's work at the machine which put erasers on pencils was $1.20. The Leo Frank case put Atlanta's Jews on trial because even though they chose to close ranks around Frank, even though four Jews were on the panel which indicted him. But the Frank trial also put the New South on trial. The boosters at the local Chamber of Commerce may have benefited financially from the new Southern economy, but the average to poor man in Georgia wasn't particularly happy about the fact that the South had been turned into a cheap labor pool for Northern industrialists because it was his daughters who ended up working there. The fact that cheap labor in the South meant child labor made the bad situation even worse. When the sexual exploitation of child labor was added to the mix, the sullen South reached the limit of its patience and demanded an expeditious trial. The Southern ruling class, which was trying to ingratiate itself with the Northern industrialists by offering the malnourished children of Atlanta as cheap labor, knew that justice delayed in this instance was an open invitation to a return of the rule of lynch law. So, the South, which was guided by honor more than the North, which was guided by cheap labor, finds itself reduced by circumstances after the war to being a cheap labor pool for the North. And among the Northern industrialists or the carpetbaggers who come down there is this Jew, and the new Jews are speeding in after 1880, is Jew Leo Frank, who, while the Southerners are off holding a parade to worship their ancestors or show respect for their ancestors after the Civil War, the Jew, Leo Frank, is molesting one of their daughters. He's first forced to work in the factory for $1.26 a week. Leo Frank and his lawyers, however, went to the trial blithely unaware of the real dynamics that informed the case. When Leo Dorsey, the state prosecutor, called a witness who claimed that he saw Frank engage in an act of sexual perversion with a local prostitute, the defense attorneys woke up to the fact that everyone, including most importantly the jury, felt that Leo Frank's character was on trial. The fact that they refused to question Frank and let him clear the air in his own character, a move which would subject him to cross-examination of the sort they tacitly admitted would harm his case, only confirmed the character issue as central in everyone's mind. When Frank finally did take the stand, he talked for hours about the ins and outs of the pencil business, further alienating his Southern audience by giving the impression that he was a totally callous, self-absorbed alien who viewed the girls who worked for him as nothing more than the robots who ran his machines. If the girls were robots, the Georgians reasoned, why couldn't the more attractive girls like Mary Fagan be seen as sexual robots as well? So we've got a classic kike here, and remember, Jews have for thousands of years been involved in the white slave trade, stealing attractive white women from Eastern Europe and selling them to Arab countries and selling them and auctioning them off in Tel Aviv. This is what Jews do. They have no respect for any other people. They have only the respect for others that is forced upon them. Naturally, they despise others and look to profit from them, for that's what they are biologically. That's the part, that's the hidden key here that the Catholic Jones won't tell you. The Jews can't change their nature because it is their nature. Realizing that their strategy was, and this part will show you just how cynical Jews are. It's Jews who claim that, you know, they're trying to help out the blacks, and Jews set up the NAACP in order to destroy legitimate black nationalists, either of the self-help or the Back to Africa school. Jews pretend to be black friends. They talk about the Black Jewish Alliance. They create the NAACP. But all they want out of blacks is a crowbar to wreck the white South and the white North, too. So the Jews decide, once Frank's character is called into question, they better play the race card. Luther Z. Rosser, R-O-S-S-E-R, one of Frank's attorneys, called Jim Connolly, the black watchman at the pencil factory, to the stand and tried his best to entrap the Negro in his own testimony. When that failed, he resorted to naked race baiting, which took two forms. In the first instance, Rosser claimed the only reason that Frank had been indicted was because of his race, implying that the South was a hotbed of anti-Semitism. "Gentlemen," Rosser told the court, "take a look at this spectacle if you can. Here is a nice Jewish boy from the north. He is unacquainted with the south. He came here alone and without friends, and he stood alone. He is defenseless and helpless. Frank's other attorney, Reuben R. Arnold. Arnold is often a Jew name. Think of Tom Arnold. Reuben R. Arnold, his other attorney, Frank's other attorney, was, if anything, even franker about the accusations the defense attorneys now leveled against the state of Georgia. I tell everybody, all within the hearing of my voice, that if Frank hadn't been a Jew, he never would have been prosecuted. So here, again, we have the typical case of a Jew committing a crime and then screaming anti-Semitism immediately. I am asking my kind of people to give this man fair play. Before I do a Jew injustice, I'd want my throat cut from ear to ear. So here's this heroic southern white man who's stepping up gallantly to defend the Jew by accusing his own kind of being anti-Semites. The defense then moved to the other prong of its race strategy, its attack on Jim Connolly in particular, and all Negroes in general, as unreliable and incapable of being trusted. So when whites say that about blacks, Jews call us racist, but the minute a Jew is on the trial for committing a crime, he tries to blame an innocent black. Shows you how utterly cynical Jews are and how they view blacks and whites, and indeed all non-Jews, as simply tools to be used for their own advantage. There's one message that Radio Astina has for you. It's that's what Jews are. They're not simply white people of another religion. They're an entirely different species of animal looking to use you and yours to their advantage, even if it means raping and killing your sons and daughters. And that's really the Jewish ideal. The white female raped and molested by a Jew in whose factory she works to make him profits, while the white son is off fighting and dying for Israel 8,000 miles away. Pandering to the lowest anti-black sentiments in the South, Luther Rosser told the jury that, quote, Connolly is a plain, beastly, drunken, filthy, lying nigger with a spreading nose through which probably tons of cocaine have been sniffed. Wow. So these Jews, remember, these Jews are the ones who talk about how bad racism is and how anti-racist they are. Hell, they invented the term racism. It didn't even exist at this point in period in 1914. Racism wasn't coined by Jew Trotsky until, I believe, the 1920s. They got a dirty black Negro, Rosser continued, and in order to give impetus to his testimony, they had a barber cut his hair and shave him, and they gave him a bath. They took rags from his back, and he came in here like a slicked onion. They tried to make him look like a respectable Negro. Rosser and Arnold's strategy was predicated upon a fundamental rule of the South. If a disputed issue comes down to the word of a white man versus the word of a Negro, the nod always goes to the white man. Neither Rosser nor Arnold, however, seemed aware that they had undermined their own case by playing up the fact that Frank was a Jew. If he were a member of an alien race from New York, a section of the United States that had been traditionally hostile to the South, it was not clear that he fulfilled the Southerner's criterion of whiteness. Beyond that, Rosser and Arnold failed to understand that in calling the citizens of Georgia anti-Semites, the defense insulted the very group they needed to persuade. Was the jury supposed to feel that they were somehow above the accusations of anti-Semitism leveled against their fellow Georgians, when the jury knew full well that it was nothing more than a randomly chosen sample of that citizenry? In other words, the stupid defense attorneys of this kike are basically smearing not just the nigger, but they're smearing the white South as well by claiming there's anti-Semitism involved here, when obviously these are just people chosen at random, and they were basing their decision on the facts of the case, regardless of how they felt about whites, blacks, or Jews. Dorsey, the state's attorney, jumped on an even more glaring inconsistency. If the state's case was motivated by prejudice, why would they ignore... The state's attorney jumped on an even more glaring inconsistency. If the state's case was motivated by racial prejudice, why would they ignore a subject as tempting as Jim Connolly and go after someone else whose Jewishness had been irrelevant until the defense raised it as an issue? Gentlemen, the state's attorney asked the jury, do you think that I or these detectives are actuated by prejudice? Kind of reminds me of the O.J. Simpson trial, huh? Going after Furman. Would we... as sworn officers of the law have sought to hang Leo Frank on account of his race and religion and passed up Jim Conley, a Negro, prejudice? Dorsey reminded the jury that it was the defense which had brought up the issue of prejudice in the first case. His rebuttal then, quote, all but obliterated the defense's accusation, unquote, and exposed, quote, the cry of anti-Semitism as a deliberate ploy to salvage a losing case. So, the Jews are grasping at any straws. They see that their man is going to go down because he's, after all, guilty. He's guilty as a Jew. And so, to try to get him out, they try to claim racism, and they try to blame it on a black man. As they would put it today. In the case of that woman, Smith, who ran her kids into the lake and then blamed a nigger because it was plausible. A short peroration on Jewish leaders, which included praise of Benjamin Disraeli and Judah P. Benjamin, allowed Dorsey to take the high ground and announce to a jury that was already sensitive to the idea the Northern Capital had unlimited rights over the South, that all men were equal when they stood before the bar of justice. Having demolished the charge of anti-Semitism, Dorsey, the prosecutor, could then probe the inconsistencies in the defense's case. What business did this man have going into those dressing rooms? Dorsey wondered, resurrecting the moral issue that the defense had been so eager to dodge. Oney underscores the shocking nature of the charges leveled against Frank's character and the effect they would have had on a jury in Georgia in 1913. Here's a picture of Leo Frank, a very, very kikey-looking kike. To accuse Frank of attempted rape and murder was bad enough, but to imply that due to some unspecified physical abnormality, he had tried to perform what most Atlantans would have considered an act of perversion and what Georgia law regarded as the capital offense of oral sodomy was devastating. There were other issues that argued for the truthfulness of Connolly's testimony, Connolly being the Negro watchman. The defense attorneys tried to discredit Connolly's claim that Frank told him he would never go to jail for the crime because he had rich relatives in New York. So the black, who's a night watchman at this factory, says that the Jew told him, I'll never go to jail because my good people up north and they'll get me out of this. And that's a very, very, very plausible thing for a Jew to have said, because that's how Jews think. Non-Jews, goyim, are to be used and discarded at the Jew's convenience, and the Jew can rely on his fellow criminals, his fellow kosher mafia, to bail him out, should trouble ever arise. This is exactly how Jews think. Why should I hang? Frank allegedly told Conley. I have wealthy people in Brooklyn. Why should I hang? I have wealthy people in Brooklyn. How, Dorsey wondered, did an ignorant Negro like Conley know that Brooklyn existed in the first place? Or that Frank had wealthy relatives there, and that, quote, they had $20,000 in cool cash out at interest, unquote, if Frank hadn't mentioned that fact to him? So this is just incredible arrogance. This is what Jews call chutzpah, is very clear from what the black says that the Jew told him. I have relatives up in Brooklyn. They have $20,000 lent out at interest. Why should I hang for a crime? The Negro will stand in for the Jew. How was it that the note which Frank claimed Conley wrote said, the Negro did it, when Conley would have said, the Negro done it? So the Jew does it. He not only puts out a piece of paper with some writing that he pretends the black wrote, he's arrogant enough to actually more or less discuss this with the black. This is how little respect Jews have for non-Jews. As Dorsey bore down on the defense's case, his words began to have their effect on the people in the courtroom. Both Frank's wife and mother burst into tears. At another point, Frank's mother stood up and called, and you talk about Jewish arrogance, Leo Frank's mother stood up and called Dorsey a Christian dog, unquote, putting another nail in her son's coffin. I mean, this is how incredibly chutzpathic, pathologically arrogant Jews are. And they talk about how racist the South is and how much of a threat it is to humans. Here's this A Jew, a kike female, is in this court, stands up and calls a prosecutor a Christian dog for telling the truth about what her Jewish son did in raping and murdering this white Christian girl. That's how arrogant Jews are. Imagine how much more arrogant they are today, now that they completely control the country. There's no way to get away from Jews. The thing to do to them is exterminate them. You can't dialogue with them. Dialogue is one of their code words. Dialogue, they don't ever dialogue or change anything about what they say or believe. It's just a way for them to get you to change what you do, because your anti-Semitism is the problem, not their Leo Frank raping and murdering your daughter, aunt, wife, niece. It's your reaction that's the problem. They have the right to do whatever they want to you. God gave them that right. You have no right to stand against them. If you criticize them or try to work against them, you're an anti-Semite. You're a member of a hate group. You need to be shut down. You don't speak for the community. The Jews who rape and molest your kind do. This is how Jews are. This is the way they actually think. Even when they're a tiny hostile minority, they're brazen enough to get up in court. The mother of this criminal gets up in court and calls him a Christian dog for telling the truth about her felony committing murderous son. Even Atlanta's pro-Frank newspaper, The Georgian, and yeah, would you think that in Georgia before 1920, there's already papers down there that are sympathetic to Jews who have murdered and raped white girls? How much worse are they today with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution when it's a total nigfest down there? Even Atlanta's pro-Frank newspaper, The Georgian, claimed that Dorsey's summation speech to the jury was a, quote, white-hot philippic, the greatest ever heard in a criminal court in the South. Unaware of the fact that their racial strategy was alienated the very jury they needed to persuade, Frank's defense attorneys continued to invoke racial prejudice without understanding that Frank's failure to confront the Negro's attack on his character condemned him in the eyes of the jury because, quote, never in the history of the Anglo-Saxon race, never in the history of the African race in America, did an ignorant, filthy Negro accuse a white man of a crime that the man declined to face him. And that man declined to face him. So, Jim Conley may be a useless nigger, although he was an employed nigger. But this brazen, arrogant kike doesn't even dare to take the stand to confront that of which the Negro accused him. And the whites on the jury naturally see this as an indication that this kike is guilty. Knowing that he couldn't deal with the issue of Frank's sexual morals directly and fearing that his race-baiting tactics had failed, defense attorney Arnold, in desperation, called for a mistrial. The plea for a mistrial was based on Arnold's claim that, quote, the behavior of the spectators throughout this trial has been disgraceful. I guess he didn't mean his client's mother. His claim was based on the fact that the judge, reacting to the fact that temperature in the courtroom had reached 91 degrees at the height of the Atlanta summer, in the days before air conditioning, ordered the courtroom's windows opened, exposing the proceedings to the scrutiny of the spectators who had assembled in the square in front of the courthouse. So, the good white men of Atlanta at this time weren't indoors in air-conditioned comfort watching niggers play football. They were standing outside of the courthouse hoping to hear a little of what went on, so that they could make judgments to protect themselves and their community. They were civilized. We are slaves. The charge of the jury intimidation would gain a life of its own as it became embellished by subsequent news accounts. So the Jews misreported what happened outside the courtroom in order to build sympathy for their own guilty member. Kill the Jew or we'll kill you, the most famous line was totally apocryphal and made up by the press as part of a campaign to exonerate Frank. So again, Jews lie. They have been known as a nation of liars for thousands of years, the common enemy of all humanity, as the Romans called them. And it doesn't bother them in the least to lie to protect their own kind. It bothers them no more to lie to protect their own kind than it does when their own kind rape and murder our kind. They are a different species. They need to be exterminated. It's the only safe, as long as one Jew is walking around free on earth, no white man is safe anywhere. Eventually, these claims, these bogus claims, made their way into the deliberations of Oliver Wendell Holmes when the Frank appeal was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. However, no one who was at the trial substantiated the claim. So the Jews are circulating fraudulent reports in their newspapers in the North, intended to create sympathy for a felon solely because he's a Jew, and they think Jews should be able to get away with anything, and no one should have the right to call them on their behavior or protect their kind from their Jewish behavior. In the end, the defense strategy failed miserably, and Frank was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death. The guilty verdict made Leo Dorsey, who was carried on the shoulders of three men through the crowd of 5,000, which had assembled to hear the verdict, a local hero. So the crowd is carrying the prosecutor on its shoulders. He's a local hero. 5,000 people show up at the courthouse to hear the verdict, and they want to see justice done to this Jew. Dorsey would go on to run for political office based on his conviction of Frank. The people of Georgia felt that the Frank case had vindicated the legitimacy of their state's institutions. Frank had had his day in court. No one had resorted to lynch law. Justice had been served. The guilty verdict, however, had the exact opposite effect on Atlanta's Jews, who began to talk about Frank as the American Dreyfus and banded together to do whatever was necessary to overturn his conviction. Frank was found guilty during one of the greatest waves of Jewish migration since the flight from Egypt, which is imaginary. It's just something Jews made up in their Bible, like the story about Masada, where they supposedly committed suicide, yet digs revealed there was nothing but pig bones where they claimed their own had bravely resisted. Beginning with the assassination of Tsar Alexander II and continuing in light of the publicity which flowed from a series of pogroms that the Jews claimed were orchestrated by the Tsarist government, millions of Russian Jews fled via ports like Hamburg to the United States and congregated in places like the Lower East Side of Manhattan. So, as we mentioned before, and as Jones is saying, during this period, 1880 to 1920, you've got Jews coming over from Russia. Jews in Russia are claiming they're trying to escape pogroms, but what the pogroms are is simply resistance on the part of Russians to revolutionary violence committed by radical Jews. But as always, the Jew styles himself as the victim, even while he's actually the aggressor, the attacker, the felon, the criminal himself. Nation of liars, as we say. So the Jews are coming over from Russia and parts of Eastern Europe, and they're settling in large measure in Lower East Side of New York, and from there come the radicals and the money to finance the radicals that would end up overthrowing the Soviet Union, not only killing the Tsar and his beautiful family, but overthrowing the Soviet Union, or the Tsar and Russia, and establishing communist dictatorship that would go on to kill over 100 million good white people, just like the people in Georgia. This huge influx of Russian Jews arrived at a time, says Jones, when the German Jews, who had been arrived during the middle of the 19th century, had achieved unprecedented political power, largely because of their influence over publishing, Broadway, and the fledgling motion picture industry. So, Jews in America before 1880 were mostly German Jews. They'd come over from what is now Germany. After 1880, they were mostly Russian Jews. And although there were some difficulties between Jews of different origins, nevertheless, they worked together to exploit their control over the mass media, which they would use to depict their own as innocent and whites as evil. And not just in America in 2008, but in Georgia back in 1915. Think about that. 1913. Taken together, all of these factors, says Jones, contributed to a situation in which American Jews were prone to see an anomalous American incident like the Frank case as part of a larger European pattern of anti-Semitism of the sort that had created the Dreyfus incident in France and the pogroms in Russia, and that made them equally determined to do something about it. The first indication of what was to come had already happened in Atlanta during the early days of the trial. Upset by what they considered the unfair coverage of the trial in the Georgian, the Jews put editorial pressure on the paper by withdrawing their advertising. This is a common Jewish ploy. They want to cut off the money strings, the money of anybody who opposes them. The other papers in Atlanta, besides the Georgian, the Journal and the Constitution, quote, paid no attention to the demands of the Jews, unquote, but they were locally owned. The Georgian was owned by William Randolph Hearst. So you understand that. There's three papers in Atlanta at that time. Remember, what are there in Atlanta today? There's one paper. The whole story of the newspaper is the consolidation. So just as politics was centralized on the national level after the political Civil War, giving a one stop from which you can control all 50 states, although it wasn't as tight of a consolidation through the media, since obviously every story, the media has to some degree to remain local. Nevertheless, a city like Atlanta would have three newspapers 100 years ago, and now with probably 10 times the population, it has one newspaper. With much more editorial control, obviously, and that's supplied by the Jews. So what they're saying is there were two local papers in Atlanta at this time. There was one that was part of a chain, and so the Jews saw that the one that was part of a national chain would be susceptible to advertising pressure since it wasn't controlled by locals. And so they went after and pressured William Randolph Hearst's paper, The Georgian, based in Atlanta. Pressure was brought to bear in New York, where Jewish influence was much stronger than in Atlanta. Gradually, Hearst succumbed to the pressure, and when he did, the editorials in The Georgian began to take a definite pro-Frank stance. So here's an example of Jews 100 years ago using their power to get the mass media. Remember, there was no TV, there was no radio back then, to get the only mass media of the day, the newspapers, to back one of their own who raped and sodomized, molested and murdered young white girls. Do you see what an evil enemy the Jews are? If someone you know had raped and murdered people, you might see to it that he got a fair defense, but you wouldn't be going out of your way to claim that he didn't do it. Well, that's exactly what the Jews are. They're using their sway to try to get their guy off, even though they know that he's guilty of murder. They know he's guilty. And they're using their power to yank advertising and cost money and get these goyim to comply and go along with portraying their criminal as the good guy, as the victim. The Jew rapes and murders, and then the other Jews get him portrayed as a victim in the media. Outrageous. So the Jews put pressure on William Randolph Hearst. They get him to change his editorials until his papers are supporting Leo Frank, portraying him as a victim. In order to placate the Jews, says Jones, the Georgian created a columnist whose only beat was the Frank trial. The columnist, who was identified only as, quote, the old police reporter, quote, and Jews love to portray themselves as non-Jews and to lend the appearance of disinterest to those people in campaigns they carry off to push their own ethnic specific agenda. They always do it in the name of, you know, I'm just an old police reporter. This is just what I see, and I'm an old police reporter. I'm just telling you, I've seen a lot of injustice in my day, but this Leo Frank case tops them all. Just an old police reporter, nothing Jewish to see here. Move along. The old police reporter was unfailingly sympathetic to Frank and before long the machinations of his Jewish backers. The Georgian would remain determinedly pro-Frank throughout the trial, something that other papers began to notice. Because when you have more than one paper, you have a little competition, and the other papers can take shots at the one paper if it's radically out of line on something. You'd think it'd be a selling point. You know, if I got to sell a newspaper in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm advocating that Jews be allowed to get away with raping and murdering Southern women, how many customers do you think I'm going to find? That's why Jews prefer
monopolies, to free competition. Free competition or capitalism is just the free market is the what they put out there. The reality is monopolistic control, whether the media, the politics, or anything else. They don't want you to have other options because they know if you did have other options, you wouldn't choose the Jew option. Because the Jew option runs against your interests. Writing in the American Mercury, and that was Mencken's magazine, Herbert Asbury, who had worked for the Georgian during the Frank trial, admitted that, quote, although evidence was constantly piling up against Frank, toward the end we worked as hard trying to prove his innocence and build up sentiment for him and against the Negro, Jim Connolly. Again, Herbert Asbury writing in the Georgian, and he was someone who had worked for, no, he's writing in the American Mercury. This guy who'd worked for the local paper, the Georgian, which is owned by William Randolph Hearst, I guess, and which paper the Jews had, or I'm sorry, which publisher the Jews had put pressure on to back Frank, or they would cut his advertising. So he appoints a special columnist, the old police reporter, to essentially defend Frank while pretending to be objective. Herbert Asbury, who worked at the paper during the Frank trial, admitted that toward the end we worked as hard trying to prove his innocence and build up sentiment for him and against the Negro Jim Connolly, even though the evidence was constantly piling up against the old kike. Reacting to pressure from Hearst in New York, who was in turn reacting to pressure from Atlanta's Jews, the Georgian opined that it was, quote, the present grand jury's duty to indict Connolly without further ado. When the grand jury did not indict Connolly, the Georgian ignored the fact that several Jews were on the panel, even though that fact constituted a stunning victory for the prosecutor. So, however they were able, for some reason there were Jews in Georgia at that time enough to put four of them on the panel that actually indicted Frank. Presumably they were not as dishonest as their cousins up in New York. But here we have a very, very good picture of media manipulation in the way that it worked back then and the way that it works today. And you have to understand that what's going on here is the very formation of the ADL. This is the case that led to the formation of the ADL, so it's only 100 times worse today. And think of this Jewish arrogance, the common themes here, Jewish arrogance, the belief that Jews should be allowed to get away with and do whatever they want. They have every right to use and abuse sexually or militarily. However, you exist purely to serve the Jew. That's the Jew's view of it. And if you fight back at all, why, you're called an anti-Semite. And that's how they paralyze you so you can't move, so that they lay their eggs in your body and their kids can eat you, just as one of those wasps lays its eggs in the body of a caterpillar. Right? That's what they see America for. America is land of milk and honey created by these stupid sucker goyim, and they're going to play us. They're going to take all of our money and our best women, and they're going to enjoy things, and they're going to make us suffer. And if they rape and murder us, tough shit for us. We'll take away the advertising money if you don't back our rapist and murderer because he's a Jew. Shortly after their complaints reached his ears, Hearst arrived in Atlanta, where he met with the city's rich Jews and the newly elected governor of the state, John Slayton. Slayton, in addition to having been elected to the highest office in the state, was also a member of the same law firm as Frank's lawyers, a fact which raised questions of conflict of interest, which became harder to avoid as the clamor to get Slayton to pardon Frank became greater. So you've got a new governor here, John Slayton. And he belongs to the same law firm as Jew Frank's lawyers. And so the Jews, the rich Jews in Atlanta and New York, are trying to get the new governor Slayton to pardon Frank. Before long, the ramifications of the case became clear for the citizens of Georgia. At issue was the rule of law and whether the law applied to all Georgia citizens, regardless of their race or wealth or connections. Having suffered through the manipulation of the political process as a form of covert Yankee-inspired social engineering during the Reconstruction era, the South had used the Klan and lynching to restore popular sovereignty. That is, there's no guarantee you're going to get justice unless you fight for it yourself. And if the Yankee six his sicko school marms and his niggers on you to attack your kids, the only thing you can do is fight back physically. And this is what the Jews were making clear in the 20th century. It was going to be different people, but the same agenda. You know, we don't want you doing what's good for your people. We want to attack you. We want you doing what's good for our people. And the only way to fight back at this was physically, because the Jews are already 100 years ago in the South, of all places, were controlling the upper ranks of the legislature, the governor, and the press. So the people had to fight back to defend themselves. That was the only way they would be defended. Now, with that era safely in the past, Georgians prided themselves on their return to the judicial process, only to be denounced by the nation's press as bigots because they had convicted a Jew in a trial that everyone in attendance had considered fair and above board. So they go through the cold, dead, slow law process rather than lynching. They arrive at a fair conclusion, and their reward is to be denounced by the Kaiken press, the Juden press, as they called it in Germany, the Jew-operated media. They're being denounced not as racist, because that term didn't exist then, but they're being denounced as bigoted because they found a guilty Jew guilty. To the average Georgian, says Jones, the fact that the state had not railroaded Jim Connolly, or the fact that a mob hadn't lynched him, was a sign that Georgia's legal system had conquered prejudice. Now the national press was attacking Georgia for a prejudice which it never knew it had, namely anti-Semitism, and ignoring all of the evidence that the trial had amassed to testify for their belief in the rule of law and fairness of the proceedings. The Georgians were in effect being called anti-Semitic bigots because they had given Leo Frank a fair trial, and not succumbed to the special pleading of the northern newspapers, most of which were owned by Jews. And that really, that's exactly the right word, special pleading. That's all Jews do. It's one standard for you, one standard for the Jew, and another standard for everybody else. And that's what they maintain across the board. It doesn't matter which direction you look. Jews always argue for one standard for treating Jews and another standard for you. If you say one little word against them, you're a guilty anti-Semite and you ought to be denied employment and cast out in the street. But if they rape and murder your kind, why, they ought to be allowed to run free. And always Jews think this way through history. Always they think this way. After Frank was found guilty and sentenced to die on October 10th, 1913, back then they didn't mess around. They had a trial in August and they're ready to hang him in a couple of months. Judge Roan, R-O-A-N, went out of his way to assure him that, "I have tried to see that you had a fair trial for the offense for which you were indicted." The people of Georgia may have agreed with Judge Roan, but the Jews were convinced that Frank was the victim of an anti-Semitic conspiracy, and it was this view which got trumpeted throughout the northern press. Once the full fury of the northern press became apparent in the aftermath of Frank's conviction, it became clear that the Jews were going to create the very anti-Semitism they wanted to avoid as the Frank case took on a life of its own, as the test case for the moral legitimacy of the New South. Who had more power, Atlantans began to wonder, the state of Georgia, and by extension the people who appointed its judges and representatives, or the New York Times and all the other Jewish-owned newspapers who were demanding Frank's acquittal and then his pardon? So, there's a good deal more to this story, so I just want to go slow and be sure that we've got it all here. So, a Jew, Leo Frank, is caught, tried, and convicted of raping and murdering and sodomizing an innocent white girl, Mary Fagan, 14-year-old. And even though all the evidence is against him, and even though he tries to railroad a nigger and blame him for what he did, Jew Leo Frank's fellow Jews rally to his defense, using their political and media power to back him fully and demand that he be pardoned, even though he's convicted of rape and murder. Says Jones, Atlanta's Jews were appalled by the verdict. They saw it as a personal attack on their community, even though up to that time, there had been no evidence of anti-Semitism in Atlanta. So, again, we see that anti-Semitism is a result of Jewish behavior. Until the Jews backed up their own rapist and murderer, nobody had anything against them. So what's the word for what Jews think about whites? I coined Loxism. These are Loxists. They hate whites. They resent whites even defending their own who were raped and murdered by Jews. And we see that Jews stick together. I was going to say, even though they're a criminal, even though their own is an accused and convicted criminal, they still defend him. Well, maybe that's the reason that their self-defense is so strong, that they are a bunch of criminals, essentially. And that, in fact, is correct. They're a genetic criminal clan that is at war with all other humans. They are not white people with a different religion, as those who have never considered the matter often believe, since it's put forward that way in the controlled media. Rabbi David Marks, heretofore leader of Atlanta's assimilationist-minded synagogue, decided to make the Frank case his personal cause. Okay, David Marks, a Jew rabbi, to be redundant, in Atlanta, is going to make Leo Frank, convicted of raping and murdering a white girl, his personal cause. Marks headed for New York, where he planned to elicit support from the heads of organized American Jewry. In a letter to one potential supporter, Rabbi David Marks from Atlanta claimed that the Frank case was, quote, without doubt an American Dreyfus case, because the evidence against Frank is purely prejudice and perjury. Again, Jews never believe they're guilty of anything. The feeling against the damned Jew is so bitter that the jury was intimidated and feared for their lives, which undoubtedly would have been in danger had any other verdict been rendered, said Jew David Marks of Atlanta. Again, Jews lie like people breathe. Like humans breathe. How do you know a Jew is lying? His lips are moving. While in New York, Rabbi David Marks from Atlanta met with Adolph S. Oaks, or Ox, O-C-H-S. It's a German Jewish name. These are the guys who own the New York Times. Publisher of the New York Times and that profession's most powerful Jew. Adolph Ox, so, he's the number one media Jew. He owns the New York Times. He publishes the New York Times. Adolph Ox. So the rabbi from Atlanta goes up there to meet with him. Marx was not going to have an easy time selling the Frank case to Ox, who had the reputation of being a, quote, non-Jewish Jew, unquote, who will, quote, will have nothing to do with any Jewish movement, unquote. Ox had rejected an invitation to join the board of the newly formed American Jewish Committee, along with the ADL, the founding of which we're discussing right now without naming it such. Is the most powerful Jewish group in America, American Jewish Committee and the ADL. So, the publisher of the New York Times is being appealed to by a Jewish rabbi from Atlanta, and even though he's a non-Jewish Jew, and he didn't join the board of the newly formed American Jewish Committee, and had sworn that the New York Times would never become a, quote, a Jewish newspaper, still, he's eventually brought around. By the end of their meeting, all the zealous rabbi could elicit from Ox was a promise to look into the matter. In fulfilling his promise, Ox got a reporter from the Atlanta Stringer in fulfilling his promise to the Jew rabbi from Atlanta, David Marks, Adolph Ox, the publisher of the New York Times, got a report from the Atlanta Stringer for the Times, informing him that it would be a mistake to support Frank, not just for Ox and the Times, but for Frank himself, who would bear the brunt of the backlash. In fact, the Stringer said, the worst thing for him that could happen would be for Jews to rally to him as Jews. So the stringer correctly tells him, like, basically, look, this guy is guilty, and if you rally around him as Jews, you're going to really create a backlash of hatred against Jews in the South because they know that he's guilty. And they can't understand for the life of them, being fair-minded white Aryans, why a Jew would object to seeing a Jew murderer and rapist executed. But Joan says, Ox made the mistake of ignoring this advice, and as the stringer indicated, Frank went on to pay the ultimate price for that mistake. So even this non-Jewish Jew ultimately decides to rally around his fellow Jew who was a rapist and murderer, even against the advice of his own stringer. Marx had an easier sell before him, says Jones, when he met with Louis Marshall, president of the American Jewish Committee. And you remember the American Jewish Committee and Marshall in relation to Marcus Garvey. Unlike Ox, who's this non-Jewish Jew running the Times, Marshall was an openly Jewish advocate who had spent the past 10 years fighting anti-Semitism. In 1911, again, Louis Marshall, this is a Jew. Louis Marshall doesn't sound like a Jew name, does it? But it is. Louis Marshall, Louis Seymour, Murray, these are names that are Aryan at one point, but the Jew adopted them because he thought they would give him social cachet that Jews needed in an era in which they were banned from the better clubs and hotels. In 1911, Louis Marshall had persuaded the United States to abrogate a treaty with Russia which prevented American Jews from freely conducting business in Russia. That their business involved selling revolvers to Jewish revolutionaries went unmentioned by the AJC in the American press. So again, these kikes are coming over here from Russia, but they're keeping up a stream of communication of weapons and money back to the old country as they prepare to radically overthrow it in the Russian Revolution of 1917. So they're coming over here and they're manipulating lawmakers into allowing them to conduct business with the old country. And Jones says, the Catholic traditionalist says, they're selling revolvers to Jewish revolutionaries. Marshall agreed with Rabbi Marx from Atlanta and felt that the Frank case met the criteria for American Jewish Committee involvement, but he feared open advocacy of the case might backfire, especially in Georgia, and create more anti-Semitism, which would in turn make overturning the verdict impossible. According to Marshall, and here we see how Jews love to operate, any action that is taken must emanate from non-Jewish sources. Oh, it's not us that want this, it's the guy that wants this. I don't want it. You know, they're gonna put up a false front to advance their own interests as either universal or non-Jewish, when in fact they are specifically Jewish. They're just hiding behind their front. That's what fronts are for. This meant creating front groups and giving the impression that the newspapers which orchestrated the campaign were reporting on a groundswell of popular opinion. So you see, they're going to pretend that the public wants this, but it's actually just Jews who want this. Marshall proposed working behind the scenes to change Atlanta's thinking. There's only one way of dealing with this matter, he wrote to another AJC board member, and that is in a quiet, unobtrusive manner to bring influence to bear on the Southern press to create a wholesome public opinion which will free this unfortunate young man from the terrible judgment which rests against him. So even though this Jew has been caught, tried, and convicted of raping and murdering this white girl, these New York Jews and their brothers down in Atlanta are going to snake around and rat around and find a way to get him out from under the death sentence imposed in August for October execution. By the end of September, articles began appearing in papers like Cincinnati's American Israelite, claiming that Frank's religion precluded a fair trial. The man was convicted at the dictates of a mob, the judge and jury fearing for their lives. This, of course, was precisely what Marshall did not want to happen, and it brought about precisely the reaction which Marshall feared. Stung by claims in the press, the jury responded by saying that it had not been influenced, much less intimidated, by the crowd which had gathered outside the courthouse. The jury felt compelled to repudiate the false reports which had appeared in the press. The buggy salesman Hensley denied explicitly Samuel Aaron's claim that he told the Atlanta Elks Club, "I'm glad they indicted the goddamn Jew." So again, you've got the Jews making up quotations, putting them in the mouths of honest white men in order to claim bigotry against themselves and thereby exonerate their own rapist murderer. This is what the top Jews do. Fish rots from the head down. They're all like this. They're all bad. They all lie to defend the criminal actions of their criminal mob. A criminal genetic clan is what the Jews are. The claim was preposterous, Hensley claimed, because the Elks had many Jewish members. Hensley was on the jury, and the Jews are lying about what he said to make him appear to be a bigot who convicted Frank because he was a Jew rather than on the evidence against him. Monroe S. Woodward, an Atlanta hardware store salesman who had served on the jury, testified that, "I did not at any time, while a juror, hear any applause except such as occurred in open court, and which was heard by the judge and the attorneys in the case. There was never any applause or cheering inside or outside of the court within my knowledge while the case was being considered." Accounts of mob intimidation in the press, followed by the vehement denials by those who were actually there as participants, confirmed the idea in the mind of Georgians that the Frank case was a contest between big northern interests controlled by Jews and the common man who still had faith in the American legal system. State's attorney Leo Dorsey articulated these sentiments when he argued in court against the new trial that the newspapers were proposing, claiming that another trial would be an attack on the people of Georgia. So you see, the Kikes, unhappy with the conviction of their own member for raping, molesting, and murdering the white girl, want a new trial. And they're claiming that bigotry is the reason they should get a new trial. And they're not above making up quotations and attributing them to people on the jury to get that new trial. So Leo Dorsey, the prosecutor who got the conviction, says, "If the verdict of guilty against Leo Frank is set aside upon such trivial grounds as the convicted man's lawyers recite in their motion, it will justify very largely the contempt in which people are beginning to hold their courts and the administration of their laws." Dorsey went on to claim that the Jews were willing to slander the entire state of Georgia in order to overturn Frank's conviction. Again, you've got a white prosecutor saying in 1913 in Georgia that Jews are conspiring to lie about the character of an entire state of people in order to get off a rapist murderer who belongs to their tribe. That's how Jews are. That's the kind of people they are, all of them. There aren't good Jews. They're all like this. They all back up their own who's a rapist murderer rather than see him receive justice. And they're going to call you an anti-Semite and a bigot. Even if that was your own daughter who'd been raped and murdered by this Jew, they're calling you an anti-Semite and a bigot. So if you're afraid of being called an anti-Semite and a bigot, you will always lose to the Jews. You can't beat them if you protest that you're not an anti-Semite. As we see here, they will use that accusation always and immediately. They don't care about logic, evidence, or anything else. They're not white people. Don't see them as whites. Don't expect them to act like white people. They're not us. They're a different species. All they do is accuse other people. That's why they win. They never defend themselves. They aren't honest. They always lie. They murder. They rape. And they defend their own. We can't live among them, nor can we tolerate them ruling over us. Dorsey maintained that race had nothing to do with Frank's conviction. "The people were not aroused against Leo M. Frank because he is a Jew, but because he is a criminal of the worst type. In the name of the Gentiles of Atlanta, I declare that when the counsel for the defense charges the jury with bias and charges Atlantans with intimidating the jury with a display of mob spirit, they are slandering the citizenship of the entire community." Moved by Dorsey's argument, the judge denied the motion for a new trial, which was the correct thing to do. On November 8, 1913, 8 days after the motion for a new trial was denied, Jacob Schiff, okay, this is the guy who funded the Russian Revolution, Jacob Schiff, and he's the Schiff of the Schiffs that Al Gore's daughter married into, S-C-H-I-F-F, and the board of the American Jewish Committee, AJC, met at the Temple Emmanuel in New York to discuss their next move. Louis Marshall again warned that any expression of Jewish solidarity which gave the impression that the Jews were determined to get Frank off the hook, no matter what, would only create the very anti-Semitism their organization strove to avoid. Marshall's caveat, however, was no match for Jacob Schiff, the most powerful Jew in America. Jacob Schiff, the most powerful Jew in America, who argued for the AJC's open involvement in the Frank case. In the end, a compromise of sorts was reached, and the AJC agreed to support Frank's case by manipulating public opinion from behind the scenes. Here you've got a guy who's part of a group of Jews that gives the Russian, quote-unquote, communists, who are really Jewish radical revolutionaries, $20 million to murder the head of Russia and take communist power. He's the most powerful Jew in America, this Jacob Schiff, and he's defending one of his own, trying to get him off, even though he knows he's guilty of rape and murder. And you want these Jews to be allowed to live among us as our equals and our fellow American citizens? That's insane. We must liberate ourselves from Jews at all costs. Whatever it takes, we must get free of them. This is the kind of people they are. The AJC vowed to retain Albert Lasker, head of a Chicago public relations firm, to orchestrate a publicity campaign from behind the scenes. Lasker had become famous and rich as the man who established famous brands such as Budweiser Beer and Quaker Oats. Remember, this is a time when the United States used to be just that. States who were united through a constitution, but who preserved for 99 out of 100 laws that mattered their independence. They could go their different ways, but you saw the rise of political consolidation. At the same time, you saw the rise of national media that made not only national politics possible, but national brands possible. And foremost among the creators of the new national brands, or more precisely the national branding campaigns, are these kikes in the new field of public relations, supposedly created by Edward Bernays, a relative of Freud, and a guy who sold the American public on the idea of women smoking and American involvement in World War I. Or in the case of Albert Lasker, Quaker Oats and Budweiser Beer. And now Lasker's going to be asked to manipulate public opinions from behind the scenes in favor of the Jewish rapist, the Jewish murderer, Leo Frank. Now his job, says Jones, was to undermine the legitimacy of the Frank verdict and orchestrate public opinion to get it overturned. Again, in Georgia in 1913. Not in New York City in 1978, in Georgia in 1913. None of the Jews, says Jones, involved in the compromise leading to the approval of this campaign seems to have considered the dangers it involved, especially for Leo Frank, whose life hung in the balance. Even the open publicity campaign, which Marshall feared, posed fewer dangers. A backlash against Jewish support for Frank had begun to manifest itself, and not just in Georgia. Even in New York, the capital of the Jewish publishing industry, there was no mystery to what was going on if the New York Sun could run headlines like, "Jews Fight to Save Leo Frank." If it could be shown that Jews were working behind the scenes to orchestrate this sort of feeling, the reaction would be that much worse. And Marshall's fears that the very anti-Semitism which they opposed would become a very ugly reality. Ultimately, all the dire predictions of the Jews became self-fulfilling prophecies. In response to the attack on the state of Georgia, its citizens and its institutions, quote, prejudice did finally develop against Frank and against the Jews, but Frank's friends were responsible for this anti-Semitic spirit. The supposed solidarity of the Jews for Frank, even if he was guilty, or maybe especially if he was guilty, caused a Gentile solidarity against him. Anti-Semitism is caused by Jews. Anti-Semitism, as we see in the Leo Frank case, is the natural reaction of the human to a Jew. The white human sees a Jew. The Jew rapes and murders a white daughter. The other Jews scurry as cockroaches as one to defend that Jew who raped and murdered the white girl. Anti-Semitism is the Jews' term for the result, and it's nothing but the natural, normal human reaction to Jewish behavior. Harold Cruz, a historian, claims that the Frank case revealed that even if Jews experienced discrimination, it had no economic consequences. And that fact called the significance of the Black-Jewish alliance into question. In his view, it was the crucial disparity between the economic status of blacks and Jews that qualified the meaning of any alleged social significance of the Black-Jewish alliance. Black marginality and Jewish marginality, far from being two sides of the coin of racial prejudice, were totally different phenomena because they had no economic common denominator. This double standard would go on to have far-reaching consequences, says Jones, but its existence emerged for the first time in the Frank case. That is, the Jews are working together economically to create a solidarity that has real and far-reaching political consequences, but they're trying to deny blacks that same economic solidarity by preaching integration and civil rights as a way to make for disintegration in the United States and the disempowerment of both blacks and whites, and Jewish empowerment, as they're the only unified, solid ethnic group that works as a team while the others are reduced to working as individuals. By the late fall of 1913, Albert B. Lasker, again this PR guy from Chicago, who has worked in the field of developing national brands, first becoming possible through the new national media, had not only agreed to orchestrate the publicity campaign to exonerate Frank, he had contributed $1,000 of his own money to the cause and had raised equal amounts from his father and fellow Chicagoan Julius Rosenwald, chairman of Sears Roebuck and Company. So the big-name Jews are lining up to try to get Leo Frank off. And they've hired one of their fellow Jews to run a publicity campaign behind the scenes to manipulate public opinion to get him get his sentence overturned. At around the same time, Adolf Ox, the publisher of the New York Times, had overcome his scruples about using his paper as the vehicle for Jewish advocacy and committed the New York Times to Frank's cause as well. So the major media, the major retailers are coming together to try to get this rapist and murderer, Leo Frank, off. What kind of a people other than a scummy people would do that? The conspiracy to exonerate Frank got into trouble almost immediately, which is not surprising considering the methods it had chosen to use. As one of his first acts, Lasker hired the famous detective William Burns, a celebrity of rock star stature in his day, who in turn set himself up in Atlanta's most expensive hotel and announced that he was going to get to the bottom of the case and solve a mystery which the courts of Georgia had already resolved. "I am in the Frank case to the finish," Burns announced after his arrival in March 1914. So now, Leo Frank is convicted in August of 1913. He's scheduled to be executed in October of 1913, but the Jews are filing motions that prolong the case and prevent the execution, and they're hiring their own detective and they're manipulating public opinion behind the scenes. Instead of informing Burns that the jury had already reached its verdict, the Hearst paper in Atlanta went along with this publicity stunt and announced in a front page headline, "Detective promises decisive probe." So they hire this Aryan rock star detective investigator to probe a case that's already settled and decided by the courts, and they use their economic power to threaten papers to go along with promoting this campaign And the Goy media magnate William Randolph Hearst yields and gives into the pressure and not only runs a columnist, you know, the old police reporter writing to try to get Leo Frank off, but they promote this out-of-state detective coming down there as though the people of Georgia and the people of the white people of Atlanta can't run their own prosecutions without New York Jews checking up on them. Now, says Jones, Albert Lasker, the man, the Jew who had paid Burns his $4,500 retainer fee for this detective to go down to Atlanta and conduct a probe, had seemingly independently come up with a slogan which would do for Leo Frank what Lasker had done for Quaker Oats and Budweiser. The phrase, "The truth is on the march," began appearing in articles on Frank across the country and from the lips of Frank himself, who included the phrase in just about all of the interviews he granted from his jail cell. So, this is how coordinated Jews are. This is why they succeed. They're working as a team to get off their own rapist and murderer. Even 100 years ago, even with whites still owning some of the media, they're brazen enough to think they can get away with this. A rallying cry had been born, and it looked as if it were making inroads in Atlanta itself when one of the locally owned papers, the Journal, reversed its previous position and came out for a new trial. Appearances in this instance were deceptive. The publicity campaign may have caused the defection of one paper, but it mobilized the opposition further by bringing another paper into the battle on the side of the Georgians. The Jeffersonian had nowhere, and here's what I said earlier, you know, when you have more than one paper and they're not all owned by Jews, then one of the papers can take the side of the people against the kikes. And that's what happened here. The national paper, owned by Goy, throws in on the side of the Jews when they threaten to boycott it, and eventually another paper is brought in, one of the local papers is brought in against the whites and in favor of the kike, also through pressure, I believe, and that allows the third paper to side with the people in a way that no paper does today, because they're all controlled by a handful of national chains, and so they all take one editorial policy. The Jeffersonian had nowhere near the circulation of the Journal. Well, the three papers here, the Jeffersonian, the Journal, and the Georgian, are the three papers in Atlanta at this time. The Jeffersonian had nowhere near the circulation of the Journal when the Frank case began, but the Journal didn't have an editor like Tom Watson, who turned out to be a genius in articulating the resentment which the common man in Georgia felt over the Frank case, and the heavy-handed interference of the Jews which provoked it. So the Georgians don't like being portrayed, as the Jews do even today, as redneck hillbillies from whom no Jew can get justice, when in fact the unjust are the ones in New York, are the kikes, who are trying to get their own rapist or murderer free, because that's what Jews do. It's more important to them that he's a Jew than that he's... They don't see him as a Jew gone bad. They just see him as a Jew who's being beset by Goyim. That's all that matters. They don't care if he's a rapist and a murderer. Many of them secretly like that. They approve of that. And their rabbis confirm them in that. The Goyim have no right to existence. They're here at the pleasure of the Jews. We can do what we want to them. Every rabbi agrees with that teaching, no matter what they feign in public. For 11 months, Tom Watson had ignored the Frank trial in the pages of the Jeffersonian, which up until that time had distinguished itself by running a series attacking the Catholic Church, in which editor Watson referred to the Pope as a fat dago. The defection of the Journal had brought Watson into the fight, so when the other local paper that wasn't owned by Hearst and a national paper, when the other local paper turned to favor the Jew over the whites and the native Georgians, the third paper, the second local paper, decides to get into the fight. And Watson was outraged at Yankee Jewish meddling in the Alabama legal system and determined to ask the questions which the other papers had pointedly ignored. Who's paying for all this? Watson wondered when William Burns, the world's highest paid detective, showed up in Atlanta. So just like a good Jew, he goes right to the motive, which is the way to counter Jews. Point out their financial and political motives. Question their motives, always and always, and only attack them. Never defend yourself. Just attack them. They are guilty. They know they're guilty. The spike in circulation that the Jeffersonian enjoyed in the wake of Watson's entry into the Frank case indicated that many other Georgians had similar questions on their minds. Does a Jew expect extraordinary favors and immunities because of his race? Again, Watson seemed not only capable but willing to articulate the questions on everyone's mind. So you had a real newspaper sticking up for the real views of most of the people, which no newspaper in America today will do. Not one will come out against open borders or against affirmative action. They're all in favor of the Jewish lies, the entire Jewish agenda. But back then, there was still the odd paper that represented white people. Is it wise, Watson continued, for the Jews to risk the good name and popularity of the whole race in the extraordinary, extrajudicial, and utterly unprecedented methods that are being worked to save this decadent offshoot of a great people? Well, that's not, as history would go on to show, that's a very unfair and inaccurate characterization of Jews. They're actually 100 times worse. They're not good people, they're bad people. There is no indication, says Jones, that the Jews who were bent on orchestrating Frank's pardon were aware of Tom Watson at this stage of the game, nor is there any indication that they would have heeded his warnings if they were. With the machinery of public relations firmly behind their cause, and with hitherto hostile newspapers now calling for a new trial, victory seemed within the grasp of the Frank camp. In the meantime, Lasker and his associates were counting for the cost, for final victory. On April 20th, this is of 1914, Lasker came up with another $5,000. Remember, this is in 1913 money, or 1914 money. On April 20th, Lasker came up with another $5,000 for the cause and an estimating that a total of $20,000 would be needed for victory. Lasker wrote what Oney calls the cordial equivalent of a shakedown letter to Lewis Wiley, the business manager of the New York Times, informing him that, quote, New York ought to give at least $10,000 and much more. Will you please get the ball in motion and raise the maximum amount you can? On April 22nd, Wiley complied with Lasker's demand by writing a letter on New York Times stationery to Jacob Schiff asking for the rest of the money. So they're hitting up the biggest Jew in America, Jacob Schiff, New York Times, the biggest paper. Biggest Jew paper in America is hitting up the biggest Jew for $20,000 they need to finish the victory of freeing rapist and murderer Leo Frank, their Jewish buddy, their Jewish co-religionist or co-conspirator, prompting, okay, so they write the letter hitting him up, prompting Oney, who's a historian, to opine that by the date Wiley wrote Schiff, by the date New York Times business manager writes the biggest Jew in America asking for $20K, the Times had clearly crossed the boundary between journalism and advocacy. So, oh, yeah, I'm a non-Jewish Jew. No, you're a fully Jewish Jew. You're backing a Jewish rapist and murderer against the courts and against the ordinary white people who are known as Americans, among which you Jews live. Tom Watson had surmised as much from his vantage point in Georgia. The state of Georgia was now on the receiving end of undeserved nationwide abuse, quote-unquote, as he phrased it in one Jeffersonian headline, and the main culprit in his campaign was New York Times under the leadership of Adolph Ox, who serves as, quote, a most useful servant of the Wall Street interest, runs a Tory paper in New York, whose chief end in life seems to be to uphold all the atrocities of special privilege and all the monstrous demands of big money, unquote. Favorable press coverage was, however, only the tip of the iceberg when it came to the conspiracy to exonerate Frank. Most of the money in that campaign was going to Detective Burns, who was using it to bribe witnesses to recant the testimony they had given under oath. So the Jews get together thousands of dollars, which meant something in 1913, to pay this detective to go down to Georgia to bribe witnesses to get their Jew Frank released, even though they know he's guilty. This is how all the Jews operate. Jews operate as one to release their fellow felon. Utterly unbelievable. And we're told the Jews are the good people. Jews are the only people who own the mass media, who control the mass media, or need to. I've made that mot many times before, but think about it. They're the only ones who have to control the media because they don't have another option. If they don't control the media, they can't put across these lies and make them stick. Because ordinary whites are fair-minded. They're not the prejudiced people and bigots of the Jewish public relations campaigns. And if they were, Jews never would have been allowed in this country. Their reputation would have preceded them. So, the big Jews organize a campaign, and they raise money to fund it, and they send a detective who's not a Jew down there, and they start promoting his real probe that with the slogan, "The Truth is on the March," and they get the convict, Leo Frank, to use the slogan as well. Meanwhile, the money they supply to this detective is being used to bribe witnesses to change their testimony. The Jewish plot to exonerate Frank blew up in the faces of the wealthy Jews who were orchestrating it when accusations of bribery began appearing in the Jeffersonian. Now, just imagine that there had not been a paper in Georgia that was owned and controlled by honest white men. No one would have ever known about these bribes. That's how important truly free media is, and free media is defined as media which is not controlled by Jews. It has no other practical meaning. How much longer, Watson asked in the April 23rd edition of the Jeffersonian, will the people of Atlanta endure the lawless doings of William J. Burns? What right does this sham detective have to tamper with witnesses that told the truth on Leo Frank, that foul degenerate who murdered little Mary Fagan? Can you imagine a white man writing like that in 2008 America and having it appear in an actual paper? Unthinkable. So co-opted, controlled, and slave-ridden is the U.S. under the Jews, under the Jewish tyranny we labor under. Watson concluded that this man Burns richly deserves a coat of tar and feathers plus a ride on a fence rail. He has been engineering a campaign of systematic lies, tending to blacken this state and tending to provoke an outbreak of popular indignation. Popular indignation did in fact break out in Marietta, Mary Fagan's hometown, when Burns and his assistant Dan Lehon, L-E-H-O-N, showed up ostensibly to bribe other witnesses. Recognizing Burns' face from newspaper photos, Robert E. Lee Howell attacked him on the street. A crowd quickly formed, and soon cries of "Lynch him!" filled the air, forcing the great detective, according to Watson's account, to run through several dark alleys as fast as his legs would carry him. So that's how sensitive people were back then. Before TV and before radio, all they had were the media, and the media told them that, look, the Jews have bought this fake detective. They're sending him down here. He is paying witnesses to change their testimony to get this guilty Jew off, this Jew who murdered and raped one of your own daughters. And whites are so aware of this and so active that the minute they see this detective appear in their town, they chase him to lynch him. They don't think he should be allowed to get away with this. They're not these passive fuckers who are sitting there waiting for football to start. Eventually, Burns and his associates were convicted of suborning witnesses, and Burns had to close his office when the Atlanta City Council revoked his license. Even though Dorsey was never able to trace Burns' money to Lasker and Schiff, Burns' testimony did, quote, irretrievable damage, unquote, Herbert Haas's words to Lasker, to Frank's cause. Even though it came close to being named as a co-conspirator in the case, the New York Times did not back off. It continued to find fault with Georgia and its legal system, giving further credence, if that was needed, to Tom Watson's charge of outside interference. When Judge Hill denied the extraordinary motion for a new trial, the Times fulminated once again that, quote, the trial of Leo M. Frank in Atlanta for the murder of Mary Fagan was from the beginning about everything that a murder trial ought not to be. Judge Hill of the Superior Court denied the extraordinary motion for a new trial, yet it is impossible to feel that the first trial was fair. The Burns debacle and the fact that Rabbi Marks had also been implicated in a bribery scheme, that's Rabbi David Marks from Atlanta, The Burns debacle and the fact that Rabbi David Marks of Atlanta had been also been implicated in a bribery scheme caused a new eruption of discord among the councils of New York Jews. I have been disgusted at the farcical methods to which Burns has resorted, the American Jewish Committee's Lewis Marshall wrote, the New York Times' Lewis Wiley, the business manager. Every one of his acts has been a burlesque upon modern detective ideas. It is deplorable that a case so meritorious as that of Frank should have been brought to this point of destruction by such ridiculous methods. I am afraid, Samuel Untermeyer, Marshall's law partner, concluded, contemplating the indictments that were sure to be handed down against Burns and Lehan, the whole business has been terribly botched. All of these revelations, of course, meant vindication for Tom Watson, who could crow, "I told you so," and have the common man of Georgia nod in solemn agreement. Now you wonder why Georgians are portrayed with the deliverance memes as sister-fucking-inbred rednecks? Well, here's where that hostility dates to. They're unhappy with the average people of Georgia standing up for justice in the case of a Jew raping and murdering one of their daughters. They demanded justice and they got it, even though the Jews tried to buy off that justice, tried to buy their way around the court's verdict. That's what Jews are and that's what Southerners are. Southerners are honorable and noble. Jews are evil conspirators. Jews are the bad guys. White Southerners are the good guys. That's the truth. As troubling as the outside influence issue had been, it was not over when Burns had been exposed as the agent of as yet anonymous Jewish backers. So the Jews put together a team, they put together the money, they put together the publicity campaign, they give it a slogan, and they send a white man down as a false front to do their dirty work of bribing justices. Since they don't have the facts or the law on their side, they have to bribe members of the jury to recant their testimony to try to get this guilty Jew off. That's how Jews operate. And even when half of this is exposed, they don't give up. They keep going. They're relentless liars, attackers, persecutors, smearers, rapists, and murderers. That's what Jews are. They're evil in human-looking form. They're of their father the devil, as Jesus said. Jews are the evil party. They are evil in human form. And all their actions show that. The same forces, says Jones, the same forces that gave Burns the money he needed to bribe witnesses could now exert their influence on the governor of the state, a man who had always been involved in a flagrant conflict of interest. "There isn't a right-thinking man of us," Watson wrote, "who does not feel troubled because of Governor Slayton's connection with the lawyers of the defense." So, Jew Leo Frank's lawyers belong to the same firm as the new governor of the state, Governor Slayton. On October 14th, 1914, so this would be, you know, a year and a couple months after the original conviction, the Georgia Supreme Court upheld Judge Benjamin Hill's motion denying Frank a new trial. The world of subsidized journalistic fantasy could inflame public opinion, but it was gaining no purchase on the mind of the judiciary. The Supreme Court claimed there was no abuse of discretion on the part of the trial judge in refusing to grant a new trial, nor was the error in overruling the motion on any of the grounds set out therein, nor did it know of any provision in the Constitution of the United States or of this state which gives the accused person the right to disregard the rules of procedure in a state and demand that he shall move in his own way and be granted absolute freedom because of an irregularity, if there is one, in receiving the verdict. Undeterred by either the Georgia Supreme Court ruling or the failure of their agent to bribe witnesses in the Frank case, the Jewish cabal turned to what had always been their strong suit, orchestrating favorable publicity. To accomplish this end, Lasker, this Chicago Jewish PR guy, tapped Christopher Powell Connolly, an Irish Catholic journalist from Butte, Montana, to write Frank's story. So again, just as they used the William Burns as an Aryan front, a white-faced stooge down in Georgia to buy witnesses, now they're going to use a different white guy, a three-named Irish Catholic journalist from Butte, as a hired hand to write rapist, murderer Leo Frank's story. Connolly was given unlimited access to the prisoner and his legal defense team, and Frank considered him his Zola, in whose book J'accuse had cleared Dreyfus's name. Dreyfus is a Jew that the French believe was falsely accused of being a traitor when in fact it was an Aryan. We'll leave aside whether they're right about that, but what they're trying to do is make the parallel and claim that Leo Frank is an innocent man falsely accused by bigoted whites and hateful southern Georgians. It was Connolly, so they got this Irish Catholic northerner coming in from out of state as their second hired hand. It's like, okay, we've tried to bribe witnesses, that didn't work. We've demanded a new trial, that didn't work. We've appealed to the Georgia State Supreme Court, that didn't work. What can we do? Let's write up a bio of this guy. But have it not written by an Irish Catholic rather than a kike, and we'll promote that. And what else can we do? You know, we'll keep up the campaign in the newspapers. And I think we're going to win. So they're still thinking that way. It was Connolly who first launched the famous "kill the Jews or we'll kill you" quote. You remember that from earlier in the story. The Jews are lying or paying whites to lie and put words in the mouth of the people gathered around outside the courthouse. Just as today the Jews promote, in A Time to Kill, they promote the fiction of white racists being a great danger to the country and attacking and raping poor little innocent Negro girls, as in John Grisham's A Time to Kill. They're willing to put bigoted words in the mouth of the South 100 years ago in order to get one of their own off, even though they knew that their own guy was a rapist and a murderer. So there are good Jews. No, there aren't any good Jews. They're all bad. They're all like that. They all support that same side. They all support their own getting away with anything. It's only whites who have a conception of non-ethnic justice, impartial justice, or race-blind justice. Only whites think that way. And that's one of whites' weak points, because it's used by other races like Jews against them. In fact, a funny thing on John DeNugent's thread, he says that in German they have a term, which I never heard of, even though I know German, blue-eyed is a synonym for naive or gullible. Isn't that funny? So, this Irish Catholic Connolly is the first to come up with this bogus line that no one ever said, "Kill the Jews or we'll kill you." But he introduced it in a way that was unverifiable, absolving himself of any accountability, while at the same time insinuating the idea into an already inflamed public mind. "On the last day I was in Atlanta," Connolly wrote, "I went to the office of one of Frank's lawyers to say goodbye. The telephone rang. 'If they don't hang that Jew, we'll hang you,' came the message." So, see, he doesn't attribute to anyone who can say that he's lying. He attributes it to someone anonymous, so he can get away with it. From Connolly's pen, the famous phrase entered the public mind as if it had been shouted by the mob at an intimidated jury, long after the jury itself had denied that this ever happened. At Connolly's hand, the man whom the prosecution had portrayed as a pervert and a child molester became a, quote, "shy, nervous intellectual." Unlike the Burns scheme, the private detective scheme, Lasker picked a winner in Connolly. The Collier's article had its desired effect by introducing the Frank case to the entire nation. So you've got one of these nationally circulating magazines in this era before TV, Collier's. And they're the Jews paid stooge, and you can believe this is not announced in the article itself. "Oh, there's a good Irish Catholic guy. He's like me. We're Irish Catholic. Look at those southern WASP bigots. They're trying to lynch an innocent Jew. This is how it's put across to fool you, white man, and why you must always pay attention to motives and never take things at face value. The Jews rely upon your being gullible. They rely upon you taking their motives at face value. That's how they're able to get away with things." Outside of the state of Georgia, the Chicago Jew PR expert Albert Lasker wrote, a friend, "The press of the United States, including the leading papers of every city in the South," think of this, every city in the South, he says, in 1914 or 15, the leading papers of every city in the South are editorially agitating public sentiment for the unfortunate Frank. So even back then, even as early as 1914 or 15, the papers of the South have been Jewed. They're supporting a guilty Jew against an innocent white. Daily, hundreds of papers are editorially crying out that Frank's execution would amount to judicial murder. Not surprisingly, the sheets leading the charge were in New York. More significant, William Randolph Hearst's flagship, The Journal, following in the footsteps of his Atlanta property, had also aligned itself with a condemned man. If Frank's life is saved, wrote Arthur Brisbane in December, Frank will owe it not least to any one of the lawyers you have paid so liberally, but to W.R. Hearst, William Randolph Hearst, a man of real power and of a kindness of heart that is not appreciated. Basically, he was a weak man who yielded to Jewish economic pressure. Through the threat of a boycott, he had his papers change their editorial tune to support a Jewish rapist and murderer against his own people. That's how disloyal whites are compared to Jews. Jews back their own even when he is a criminal. Whites won't even back their own when he's not a criminal. Big problem. We see that even in 1914 and 15, Jews were operating as a team against the white nation that was gracious enough to let them in, and it made a lethal mistake in doing so. The Collier's article, again by our Irish Catholic defending the guilty Jew, coupled with sympathetic treatment in the Hearst papers and the New York Times, had the desired effect, says Jones. Outside of Georgia, the perception that the state and its citizens were involved in an anti-Semitic persecution of an innocent man became universal. They had successfully falsified history through its first draft, its reporting in the newspapers. Largely inside Georgia, however, the opposite was true. Largely as a result of the work of Tom Watson, Georgians came to see the Frank case as an attack on their state and their way of life that was being orchestrated by the rich Jews who owned the Northern Press and were using it as a weapon against the South. Never before in the history of this country, Watson wrote in December 4th, 1914, has any convicted criminal been given the freedom of the daily papers that Frank has enjoyed. Simultaneously with the appearance of this stuff in the Georgia papers, it appears in the Northern papers, which are owned by rich Jews. Simultaneously with the appearance of this stuff in the Georgia papers, it appears in the Northern papers, which are owned by rich Jews. So he's saying the co-opted Georgia papers, along with the rich Northern papers owned by Jews, are putting out the same balderdash line. The Baltimore Sun, owned by the Abels, the New York World, owned by the Pulitzers, and the Times, owned by the Ox, seem to receive Frank's statement by telegraph at the same time that he hands out the copy to the dailies in Georgia. So, just as a school of fish or a flock of birds moves in unison, so does the Jew-controlled media in the U.S. in 1914. They move as one to defend a guilty Jew and to defame innocent whites. And the same thing goes on today, except it's a hundredfold larger and across three or four major media that didn't even exist in 1914. This is how damaging it is to allow Jews to control the media in white nations. Any white nation that allows Jews to control the media soon finds itself undermined. Its very life and liberty are put at risk by allowing Jews to control the media, because they are liars. They are of the devil. They are evil incarnate, these Jews. Watson was quick to point out the hypocrisy of the press accounts. Normally, the North criticized the South for its treatment of the Negro. However, groups like the NAACP and the other racial watchdogs of the North were silent when Frank's defense team launched into racial tirades which described Jim Connolly as a cocaine-sniffing nigger whose testimony couldn't be trusted because the man giving it was black. So again, one standard for Jews, another standard for everybody else. Yeah, the Jews love niggers until a nigger accuses a Jew, and then he's guilty. Then all that racism that's off grounds when whites use it, even when whites use it honestly, becomes in grounds and legal for Jews to use when they're using it dishonestly. They're relying on the stereotype. While it's generally true that niggers are useless cocaine sniffers, in this specific instance, the Negro wasn't lying, but they still racially defamed him. White racists don't even do that. apparently this type of racial slur was acceptable if it was used to get an acquittal for a Jew. Watson was quick to point out other forms of hypocrisy as well. In the Frank case, the great point emphasized by the Jewish papers is that the main witness against Frank was a Negro. It seems that Negroes are good enough to hold office, sleep in our beds, eat at our tables, marry our daughters, and mongrelize the Anglo-Saxon race, but are not good enough to bear testimony against a rich Jew. So the Jews pushing disintegration as a policy to destroy the white South and eventually the entire white nation and the white West, because they're doing the exact same thing outside of America too, turn around and insist that a black man's word can never be used against a Jew. He's good enough to marry your daughter, and we encourage him to marry Mary Fagan, but his word cannot be used when our own rape and murder the Mary Fagans of the world. In no case does the white have any rights against the Jew. Whatever the Jew says is right, whether it's one thing for the Negro over here and against the Negro over here, doesn't matter. Whatever the Jew says goes. That's what happens in a country controlled by Jews. That's why you can't allow Jews to control your country. Watson was not alone in feeling this way. The circulation figures of the Jeffersonian proved that he was adept in formulating the issues in ways that articulated the frustrations which the common man felt in this case. So the white man's paper circulation is going up because he's speaking for the people, whereas the Jews are telling lies. But the Jews have a close enough to monopoly control even 100 years ago compared to today, when they have near complete monopoly control of the media and the advertising. They own the retailers, and they can withhold or use their advertising power to make sure that their line and only their line is put out. But it wasn't just the common man who was incensed at the coverage of the Frank case in the Northern Press. Thomas Loyless, L-O-Y-L-E-S-S, editor of the Augusta Chronicle, accused the Times and Adolf Ox, that's the New York Times Jew, of slandering the people of Georgia by making it appear, quote, that Frank's race or religion had anything whatsoever to do with his conviction, unquote. In mid-January, former Georgia Governor Joseph Brown wondered aloud in the pages of the Augusta Chronicle, are we to understand that anybody except a Jew can be punished for a crime? And yes, that's exactly what the Jews maintain. A Jew cannot commit a crime against Goyim. Jews can do whatever they want to Goyim. It's perfectly legal. Any competent rabbi will confirm that. Brown's statement was a sign that the lines were hardening. It was now Georgia versus the world. Georgians who thought that Frank deserved a new trial were seen as traitors. As the Kansas City Star's McDonald had observed, the managing editor, associate editor, city editor, assistant city editor, and court reporter of an Atlanta newspaper said to me they knew Frank was entitled to a new trial, but we dare not. We would be accused of being bought by Jew money, they answered. On the other hand, the American Jewish Committee was in no mood to back down because they, quote, understood that Supreme Court justices read the New York Times and could be influenced by a national hue and cry. With the case headed back to the Capitol, he made the calculated decision that continuing coverage by crusading northern newspapers was of greater strategic value than not. So they're going to keep up their campaign of lies and hope to get this case brought to the Supreme Court, not of Georgia, but of the U.S., and have the verdict thrown out and a new trial guaranteed, which they can prejudice in the way they've been prejudicing things all along since the original verdict. However, even after the Irish Catholic Connolly's article appeared in Collier's and caused a stir nationwide, enkindling new hope in Frank, the news on the judicial front continued to be bad. Frank's last judicial hope now lay with the Supreme Court of the United States, and this is where Marshall, Lewis Marshall, the Jew head of the American Jewish Committee, AJC, and Frank's legal team directed their attention. A delegation of AJC lawyers headed by Marshall first paid a call on the Supreme Court Justice Joseph R. Lamar, who found the issue unworthy of review. Then on November 26th, the AJC turned to Oliver Wendell Holmes, in whom they found a more sympathetic reception. On February 25th, 1914, it's about a year and a half after the original trial and verdict, Frank's case was heard by the Supreme Court of the United States. So, a year and a half after the verdict, they're able to get the decision appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they're carrying on a national newspaper campaign and various dirty tricks beneath the surface to try to win a reversal or a new trial. And by February, the end of February 1914, they're in the Supreme Court, and the Kike Lewis Marshall is leading off with his version of the kill the Jew or we'll kill you story of jury intimidation. So, again, these are the very top Jews in the land are willing to lie to get off a Jew who is a convicted rapist and murderer. Think about that. Think about that. They say a fish rots from the head down. If the very richest, most intelligent, best organized, and leading executive directors of Jewish organizations are liars, do you think that the average Jew is any better? So, Lewis Marshall is up there at the Supreme Court deliberately repeating lies invented by a bought-off journalist and placed in the mouth of the honest white men who, going by the evidence, convicted a Jew. And that's what they're guilty of in the mind of a Jew, is finding a Jew guilty who was guilty. And these are the type of people who now control our law schools, as well as the media. Think about that. And you wonder why there's crime in the streets, and niggers and Mexicans are allowed to invade and get away with everything, and you have to house, feed, and employ them. Or you're a hater. Think about the ways in which the Jews can use their power to deny our ordinary existence and our living ways. That's what this ultimately means. The Jews are a genocidal threat to our people and our mindset and our way of taking the world. The crowd marshaled toward the court almost trespassed upon the jury box, hanging over the jury box, and their whispers were heard throughout the courtroom. Kill the Jew or we'll kill you is what they were saying. Watson attacked Marshall's testimony, attacking, quote, the outsiders who cannot or will not weigh the facts which proved Frank's terrible crime. If Frank's rich connections keep on lying about this case, something bad will happen. At this time, white people didn't take shit. They knew the Jews were stirring against them and telling lies. They're like, look, we're not going to take it. In the end, Marshall and the AJC got no farther with the Supreme Court than they had gotten with the legal system in Georgia. By a margin of 7-2, the court upheld the denial of Frank's petition for a new trial and denied every point Frank's lawyers made. In his dissent, Holmes claimed, mob law does not become due process by securing the assent of a terrorized jury. But there was no basis in fact to the claim that the jury had been terrorized, so Oliver Wendell Holmes was serving the Jew. That's why he's considered a famous jurist. Only those who toe the Jew line go down in history as the good guys. It was becoming clear that anything that happened in the South, which the Northern press disliked, could be characterized as mob law. But the 7-member majority in the court was not impressed with this sort of slur. In our opinion, the court concluded, he is not shown to have been deprived of any right guaranteed to him by the 14th Amendment or any other provision of the Constitution or the laws of the United States. Frank took the verdict calmly, claiming that, quote, I will never suffer the death penalty because, quote, truth will ultimately prevail, unquote. In the end, even though, as the New York Times put it, justice to Frank doubted by Holmes, the Supreme Court refused to overturn the decision of the Georgia court. This meant that there was only one hope left, and that hope resided, as Tom Watson feared, with Governor Slayton, who is now approaching the end of his term as governor. Having lost their cause at the Supreme Court, so they've gone through the whole legal system, and they've even perverted the press. They paid off a detective to pay off jurors to recant testimony, and they still haven't gotten their way. Do they give up? Nope, they keep going. They're going to try to get the governor to commute the sentence. Having lost at the Supreme Court, Lasker, Connolly, and Rosenwald, so a Jew PR guy, a Jew retailer, and a hired hack who's an Irish Catholic named Connolly, focused their efforts on Governor Slayton, who again belongs to the same law firm as the two lawyers defending this guilty Jew. And he was scheduled to leave office in June 22, 1915. From the time the Supreme Court handed down its decision in the spring of 1915 until late June, Slayton was bombarded with letters and telegrams from
United States senators representing Connecticut, Idaho, Illinois, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, as well as the governors of Arizona, Louisiana, Oregon, Michigan, Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Virginia. So the Jews are coordinating a letter campaign from high-level politicians to get off one of their own who they know to be guilty, and who's been found guilty at every step of the court system. In addition to letters from prominent figures, Slayton received more than 100,000 letters from the non-prominent and petitions containing over 2 million signatures. So he's kind of the Mamiya of his time. He's utterly, thoroughly, 100% guilty. But because of the power of the Jew media, all kinds of people are writing to get him off, to get his sentence reversed. Everyone seemed convinced that Frank was innocent. Everyone, that is, says Jones, but the people of Georgia. And the man who articulated their position best, Tom Watson. Tom Watson urged Governor Slayton to stand firm in the face of a publicity campaign waged by the millionaire Jews, quote-unquote, and their press agents. On May 27th, less than a month from Slayton's last day in office, Watson once again brought up the conflict of interest issue, claiming that it was, quote, embarrassing to the majority of Georgians that John M. Slayton is a member of the law firm to which Frank's leading attorney belongs. I guess one of Frank's attorneys belonged to the same law firm. Watson then went on to deliver a warning. Quote, the governor of Georgia should consider, one, that if the law is not allowed to take its course in the Frank case, we might as well abolish the law and save all future expense of similar mockeries of justice. Two, that if the prison commission or the governor undertake to undo in whole or in part what has been legally done by courts that were established for that purpose, there will almost inevitably be the bloodiest riot ever known in the history of the South. 1915 Georgia, we're talking here. It's the spring of 1915. Jew has been found guilty years earlier. He's been sentenced to hang. The sentence has been appealed to the highest court in the land and hasn't been overturned. It's allowed to go forward, and now the Jews are pushing their last card. They're playing their last card, which is their hopes of influencing through national media campaign, a letter-writing campaign, petition-signing campaign. They're hoping to instigate the commutation of the sentence of their fellow tribesman, who, although he's a rapist and murderer, that matters little beside the fact that he's a Jew, and he's allowed to do those things to white girls. Both Watson and Slayton knew that Georgians were united in support of the death penalty for Frank. Georgians were offended by the meddling of outsiders. They were particularly upset about the machinations of rich Jews. Fred Morris, a lawyer and former University of Georgia football star, weighed in by claiming Mary Fagan was a poor factory girl. What show would she have against Jew money? When they found they couldn't fool the people of Georgia, they got people from Massachusetts, New York, and California to try to raise trouble. Well, we throw the advice of these outsiders back in their teeth. To hell with them and what they think. A delegation from Marietta, Mary Fagan's hometown, told the prison commission, "We believe the evidence shows Frank guilty." People outside of Georgia who have read biased, I might say subsidized, accounts of this case have been urging you to commute. But if you commute this sentence, capital punishment might as well be abolished. If ever the extreme penalty should be enforced, it is in this case. Outside of the building where the commutation hearings were held on Frank's fate, thousands of Georgians gathered to hear Fiddlin' John Carson sing his latest composition, The Ballad of Mary Fagan. A performance which, by the very fact that it took place, underscored the widespread sentiment that Georgians had to hold the line against outside influence if they wanted to honor the memory of Mary Fagan and prevent the same thing from happening to their other daughters. In the hearings themselves, Hugh Dorsey hammered away at the line of argument which had sustained Frank's guilty verdict over the course of seven separate appeals. Addressing the issue of jury intimidation, specifically the cry of "Hang Frank or we'll hang you," Dorsey declared that the record shows that at no time, from the beginning to the end of the trial, did anybody cry out against Frank or offer to do him harm. It was a pure Jewish lie. Dorsey concluded his testimony with a warning, "I am fearful that if the verdict of juries in plain cases, as I conceive this to be, shall not be carried out against the influential as well as the friendless, it would be an incentive to lawlessness in our state, the consequences of which no man can calculate, and I am unwilling even passively to be a party to the encouragement of such a situation." That is,
the trial and conviction of this Jew were carried out absolutely by the book, and anyone who says otherwise is a goddamned liar and is going to have to answer for the mob justice that's going to ensue. On Monday morning, Georgians awoke to the news that Governor John Slayton had commuted Frank's sentence. And although some agreed with Slayton's decision, outrage quickly spread through the population, and the city's normal routine ground to a halt as people digested what had happened. These rich Jews, after carrying on a years-long campaign, have been able to get our weakling governor, Slayton, to commute the sentence of someone he, they, and we know to be guilty of the raping and murder of a white girl. Outrageous. They weren't sitting around watching passively niggers playing football and in between niggers fucking white girls in the ads. They were outraged and they decided to do something about it. This is how you solve the Jewish problem. You kill the Jews. Their behavior shows they deserve nothing less. Before long, the outrage which the majority of people felt at the commutation found expression when at 8:30 a.m. a mob shouting, "Pay the governor a call!" started marching towards Slayton's mansion 6 miles away. As some indication of what they planned to do, when they got to the governor's mansion, the mob broke into hardware stores along the way in search of guns. Police Chief Beavers, along with 50 mounted men, confronted the mob halfway to Slayton's mansion, turning back roughly half of the men, which meant, of course, that 2,000 armed men were headed toward the governor's mansion. And this is why the Jew doesn't want you to own guns, because you might take justice into your own hands and kill the Jew who is raping and murdering your people. You can't buy guns in hardware stores today. They're hard to find to buy. And the Jews have made it that way. They want to be able to lie, to murder, to rape, to steal, to kill, to genocide at will without your having the words or the weapons to resist them. This is why you must be a white nationalist. We are the only ones who stand up for your people against these evil Jews. What they planned to do had become apparent after another mob hanged the governor in effigy in the town square. Around the effigy's neck hung a sign proclaiming John M. Slayton, King of the Jews and traitor governor of Georgia. Just as our politicians today deserve to be killed, deserve to be hanged, because they are nothing but the kings of the Jews, the servants of the Jews, traitors to their own people. In the end, it was only the state militia and its machine guns and the fact that Slayton declared martial law which saved him from the rage of the mob and the noose they had prepared for him. And that's why we have the Second Amendment, to kill corrupt politicians. It has nothing to do with hunting. It has to do with hunting Jews and the traitors they buy from our ranks. We, the people who founded America. We, the only Americans. Not just the real Americans, the only Americans. Whites are Americans. The reaction to the commutation followed along the lines that had already been established by the publicity campaign to save the Jew Frank. Slayton received hosannas from the national press, and the New York Times led the way, proclaiming that if Governor Slayton looked beyond the boundaries of the state of Georgia, he can know and feel to how high a place he has raised himself in the esteem and admiration of the whole country. Governor Slayton has saved Georgia from herself. He has made his name illustrious. He receives the fawning praise of the Kaiken Press, the Juden Press, the Schlange Press. Needless to say, the New York Times did not articulate the feelings of the majority of Georgians. As in the past, the job fell to Tom Watson, who, like Hugh Dorsey, claimed that the governor's decision had undermined the rule of law. Watson once again brought up the issue of conflict of interest, claiming that either his firm should have withdrawn from the case or he should have been withdrawn from the firm. But the big issue was the betrayal of the people of Georgia who had elected Slayton to office. Instead of representing the interests of the people who had elected him, Slayton ended up selling out to rich Jews from New York. The real issue, as Watson framed it, was money. Jew money has debased us, bought us, and sold us, and laughs at us, precisely as it does today. In Watson's eyes, Slayton's commutation of Frank's sentence abolished the rule of law in Georgia, establishing in its place one law for the rich
and another law for the poor. According to the new law, those with unlimited money and invisible power can prey on young Georgia girls with impunity because they have established the precedent in Georgia that no Jew shall suffer capital punishment for a crime committed on a Gentile. Tom Watson. Needless to say, Watson and his readers found this state of affairs intolerable, but when confronted with the question of what are the people to do, the only answer Watson could come up with was lynch law. Hereafter, let no man reproach the South with lynch law. Let him remember the unendurable provocation, and let him say whether lynch law is better than no law at all. As some indication that Watson was articulating the feelings of a significant percentage of the population of Georgia, a mob of 200 men opened fire on the governor's mansion at 2 o'clock in the morning of June 22, 1915, Slayton's last day in office. Very good deal here. White men with guns shooting the governor, shooting at his office. Exactly what we need today. White men killing the traitors in charge, killing the traitors and the Jews who paid them to undermine our country and leave our women open to predation from nigger subhumans. Violent revolutionary activity is needed to drive them out of control. This was just the beginning of what was going to be a long day for the outgoing governor. When Governor Slayton left the Capitol after giving his farewell address, a mob descended on his car shouting, "Lynch him!" At this point, a man in the mob tried to assassinate the governor. Eventually, the governor was able to escape from the mob, but he did not return to his mansion. Instead, he and his wife escaped by train to New York City, where upon arrival he checked into the Waldorf Astoria Hotel and held a press conference, at which he was accorded the sort of welcome usually reserved for war heroes. Again, all of official New York, all official Jewry is celebrating this white traitor who accepted money in exchange for letting off a Jew guilty of raping and murdering a white girl. And this is the case that led to the founding of the ADL that claims it's anti-defamation. What they're really against is not defamation. They're in favor of defamation. They're in favor of defaming honest whites, honest Southerners, honest Georgemen, and they're against the defamation, more accurately, the description of the Jew criminals who rape and murder our women, or who allowed the niggers to rape and murder our women, and the whites who write about it honestly. They're all for the defamation of us, the good people, the real Americans. In a move that seemed calculated to confirm the citizens of the state of Georgia in their suspicion that Slayton had sold out to Jew money, Slayton and his wife then celebrated a night in the town with William Randolph Hearst after a dinner party at the publisher's palatial apartment. After a summer-long vacation and cross-country train trip, the Slaytons joined up with the Hearsts at San Simeon, Hearst's version of Xanadu on the California coast. From there, the Slaytons sailed to Hawaii. If this was political exile, the Slaytons seemed to be enjoying it. As the stories of Slayton being feted by the rich New Yorkers filtered back to Georgia, the outrage spiked upward once again. The Georgians, who were outraged at the commutation on Frank's sentence, were even more outraged at the welcome their traitorous governor received in New York, and at a certain point, a group of them decided to take the law into their own hands. A group of 150 Mariettans, that's the town that Mary Fagan was from, Marietta, Georgia, joined together on the day the commutation was announced to form the Knights of Mary Fagan and vowed revenge on both Slayton and Frank. At around the same time, a much smaller and more influential group of men came to the same conclusion and hatched a plan that was nothing if not audacious. They planned to abduct Frank from the state prison farm in Milledgeville, transport him halfway across the state, and then hang him in Marietta, Mary Fagan's hometown. Tom Watson was informed of the conspiracy to murder Frank and kept up the drumbeat of publicity throughout the summer of 1915. On August 12, 1915, in response to a blatantly pro-Frank documentary produced by Marcus Lowe, Watson wrote, "Let the rich Jews beware. The next Jew who does what Frank did is going to get exactly the same thing that we give to Negro rapists." Then on August 17, the cabal carried out its threat. Frank was abducted from the state prison farm in Milledgeville, transported to Marietta, and hanged. The guilty Jew was dead. He was brought to justice by white men with anger and guns, not by people turning the other cheek, preaching that love is all, that we have to put up with every possible form of discrimination and abuse under the sun, but men who took arms and in opposing ended the Jewish tyranny in the state of Georgia, just as we can end the Jews today and their control over us. On August 17th, the cabal carried out its threat. Frank was abducted from the state prison farm in Milledgeville, transported to Marietta, and hanged. The guilty Jew dangled. The lynching of Leo Frank set off an orgy of vituperation in the press of the sort the nation had not seen since the hanging of John Brown back in the 1800s. Newspaper after newspaper condemned the South in the words of the Chicago Tribune as, quote, a region of illiteracy, blatant self-righteousness, cruelty and violence. Until it is improved by the infusion of better blood and better ideas, it will remain a reproach and a danger to the American Republic. If Georgia approves lynching upon the New York Times, then honors bestowed upon the lynchers would attest to the shameless courage of the Georgia public and its willingness to defy public opinion in these other states of the Union. So they don't like it when whites are the chutzpah to see that the true law is carried out. And for good measure, the Akron Beacon Journal added, Georgia is a good place for every decent man and woman to stay away from. And today the Jews are sticking thousands upon thousands of Somali niggers in the middle of Ohio. The outrage continued to grow in New York. 20,000 Jews showed up for the protest meeting at the Cooper Union, a crowd which overflowed the hall onto the surrounding streets. So 20,000 Jews, and people say, oh, there's good Jews, and they're not all bad. There's good Jews, too. Well, 20,000 Jews show up, and they're angry that one of their own had his sentence carried out. They're angry that a Jewish rapist, a murderer, was put to death per court order. So you tell me if there are any good Jews, because there aren't. There aren't any good Jews. It's a lie. At a meeting at Faneuil Hall in Boston, Jews heard speeches whose rhetoric equaled in radicalism only in the days before the Civil War and resurrected memories of the abolitionists. Fired by this sort of rhetoric, the crowds demanded retaliation, and suggestions ranged from boycotting peaches and Coca-Cola to promoting guerrilla warfare. Groups of detectives were dispatched to Marietta, but they uncovered nothing because every stranger who comes into town is under observation the moment he arrives. The surveillance is not obtrusive, but it is unmistakable. The town's mood is one of determination to protect the man who, in its eyes, executed the law after it had been trampled on. It is a resolve that not a hair on their head shall be harmed. So the people, as one, rose to defend themselves from this Jewish treachery, and from the treachery of the men the Jews bought to carry out their evil mission. Tom Watson remained defiant in his defense of the lynching. In putting the sodomite murderer to death, the Vigilance Committee has done what the sheriff would have done if Slayton had not been of the same mold as Benedict Arnold. Let Jew libertines take notice. Georgia is not for sale to rich criminals. Watson's defiance, coupled with the fact that no one was indicted for Frank's murder, caused the Boston Post to wonder, is Georgia in America? Again, no one was indicted for Frank's murder, for bringing him to justice, and that's the way it should be. When you rid your community of the Jew, you have committed an act of justice. And the Jews are only angry because their kind isn't allowed to get away with raping and murdering whites as they feel he should be. Sobered by what had happened and now relieved of its duties as what amounted to Frank's propaganda ministry, the New York Times tried to make sense of Frank's killing and the role it had played in bringing it about. In an article entitled Frank Lynching Due to Suspicion and Prejudice, Times reporter Charles Thompson finally got to talk, quote, honestly about the sentiment of Georgia, unquote, a verdict which implied that hitherto that had not been the case at the Times. Thompson gave three reasons for the lynching. First, the citizens of Georgia believed that the Jews of the country, hitherto not the object of any hostility or dislike, had banded themselves together to save a criminal because he belonged to their race and religion, and thus ranged themselves in opposition to men of other races and religions, which is exactly what it was. Against this belief, no argument was effective, no denial was listened to. Second, the bitter resentment over what everybody in Georgia whom this correspondent has talked calls outside interference. And this does not mean only the interference of the New York newspapers by a long shot, though Tom Watson has done his level best to make it appear that the New York newspapers are attempting to govern the state of Georgia. Third, and this is a thing which turned the smoldering fire into a raging flame,
and maddened men who were merely angered. It is believed from one end of the state to the other that Governor Slayton was Frank's lawyer and pardoned his client after every court had upheld that client's conviction. The ignorant believed that Slayton was bribed, or that at best he received as Frank's lawyer a share of the fee paid to his firm. The more intelligent believed that he was merely influenced in his judgment by the fact that Frank was his firm's client. Thompson's article in the New York Times was a rebuke to the Times' publisher, Adolph Oakes, Jew, who was chagrined by what he read because it implied that Tom Watson was right. And then ultimately it was the overreaction of influential Jews like Oakes, or Ox, which had led to Frank's hanging. Ox had gone against his better judgment in putting the Times at the service of Frank's cause, and, quote, the Times had overstepped its bounds by persistently editorializing on his behalf. Oakes had ignored repeated warnings, at first from a stringer in Atlanta, and then from W.T. Anderson, editor of the Macon Telegraph, a newspaper which had consistently opposed lynching. Anderson had written to Oakes on behalf of, quote, the decent people of Georgia, claiming that it was the outside interference of the Jews led by the Times that had made it necessary to lynch Frank. The Jews, in fact, were responsible for what had happened to him. The men responsible are the Strausses, the Oakses, the Pulitzers, and the other leading... Hold on a second. Pardon that interruption there. We got to get back to where we were, and what we're talking about is the conclusion of this article on the lynching of the decent people of Georgia. Anderson had written to Oakes on behalf of the decent people of Georgia, claiming that it was the outside interference of the Jews led by the Times that made it necessary to lynch Frank. The Jews, in fact, were responsible for what had happened to him. The men responsible are the Strausses, the Oakses, the Pulitzers, and the other leading Jews of New York and the East generally. These men now hold the comfort, safety, peace, and happiness of the Jews of Georgia in the hollow of their hands. So these rich Jews are teaming up to liberate one of their own who has raped and murdered a white down in Georgia, and then they're angry that the people of Georgia actually react to that instead of just putting up with it, like they've conditioned people to do today. Oakes was shaken by the rebuke. Not only had he turned the Times into a Jewish newspaper by his naked advocacy of Frank's case, he had brought about Frank's death as well. Confronted with these arguments at an editorial meeting on the Frank case, Oakes appeared wan and subdued. As one of Oakes' associates put it at this meeting, the simple facts of the case were inescapable. Mr. Oakes was the prominent newspaper publisher in the country. He was a Jew. The Times had printed more stuff for Frank than any other newspaper and had a special correspondent in Georgia. A majority of the people in Georgia approved of the law having been taken into the hands of the mob because they believed that the money had been used to thwart justice. Unable to counter the charges leveled against him in the Times, Oakes decided that the Times was going to drop the Frank case. Oakes then spent the next few days at home, quote, nursing his nerves, unquote. In his own postmortem, Tom Watson claimed that the Frank case was punishment for the sinful economic exploitation of children. The National Pencil Factory, owned by Frank's people, fought our child labor bill fiercely and helped to kill it. And in God's mysterious way, it cost the superintendent his life. In closing ranks behind Frank, the nation's wealthy Jews had, quote, blown the breath of life into the monster of race hatred, and this Frankenstein, whom you created at such enormous expense, will hunt you down. So what we see here is the Jews thinking that the people of the South are free to be exploited economically and socially and sexually in every possible way, to be made the butt of ridicule, to be literally raped and murdered with no consequence, and that everyone who says otherwise is a ridiculous, ignorant hillbilly who needs to be thrown in jail or denounced as a racist. And when they tried to get away with this in 1915 in Georgia, they weren't able to. And in response, they formed the ADL. As even the non-white nationalist Catholic E. Michael Jones says, as a result of the Frank case, the Jews declared war on the South. Let me repeat that. As a result of the Frank case, the Jews declared war on the South. Lewis Marshall of the AJC tried to get Watson tried for obscenity, but Watson remained defiant. So here you go. So you've had the Jews organize a national campaign and put in tens of thousands of dollars, hire a detective to bribe witnesses, take the case to the Supreme Court, then, when all of that failed, get the government to commute the sentence. And they're still, even after all, they do all this and they lose. They even when they seem to have won, they lose. They get the guy killed because the Southerners are still enough of a people to stand against these outside interferers. Then they go after the main guy who, they decide to go after the region, the state, and the man who led the people in bringing justice to this guilty Jew. And Lewis Marshall, the Jew who's head of the AJC, tries to get Watson tried for obscenity, which is a nice bit of Jewish chutzpah since they're the main fomenters and spreaders of obscenity. But Watson remained defiant, informing the Attorney General, "You cannot remove me from the Southern District of Georgia. If I have to give up my life for having incurred the savage hatred of the rich Jews, it will be given up right here in the same region where my ancestors gave up theirs." And that's the true Southern spirit talking. Marshall's attempt not only failed, in failing it probably bolstered Watson's political career, contributing to his eventual election to the United States Senate. It backfired in other ways as well. On page 1 of the September 2nd edition of the Jeffersonian, Watson called for the resurrection of the Ku Klux Klan. "The North can rail itself hoarse if it chooses to do so, but if it doesn't quit meddling with our business and getting commutations for assassins and rapists who have pull, another Ku Klux Klan may be organized to restore home rule." The Klan, which Nathan Bedford Forrest had disbanded in 1869, had experienced a surge of renewed interest when D.W. Griffith turned Thomas Dixon's novel, The Klansman, into The Birth of a Nation, which premiered in January 1915 when the clamor over the Frank case had reached its peak. The NAACP had tried to block distribution of the film, but those efforts came to naught when Griffith persuaded his college classmate, Woodrow Wilson, to view the film in the White House. Less than 2 weeks before The Birth of a Nation opened in Atlanta, William Joseph Simmons and 34 other men had climbed to the top of Stone Mountain, Georgia, and ignited a giant cross, which has been soaked in pitch and kerosene, announcing the rebirth of the Klan. Simmons had already filed a petition with Georgia's Secretary of State on October 16th, signaling his intention to resurrect the Klan and become its imperial wizard. Leo Frank's role in all of this became apparent when it was revealed that several of the 34 men who climbed Stone Mountain that Thanksgiving evening in November 1915 were members of the Knights of Mary Fagan. That is the group that, one of the groups that met to bring justice after the treacherous governor had commuted the sentence of her raper and killer. The restored Klan reached the height of its power at the Democratic Convention of 1924, but it too fell into decline as a result of the young woman's murder, of a young woman's murder. In 1926, David C. Stevenson, who had ousted William Simmons from the leadership of the Klan and was at that time Imperial Wizard, was convicted of second-degree murder in the death of Madge Oberholzer, whom, with the help of other Klansmen, he had kidnapped, raped, and abducted to Chicago from Irvington, Indiana. The case, which included some revolting perversions, created a widespread revulsion against the Ku Klux Klan. Throughout the 1930s, its influence weakened irreparably. In 1944, it was formally dissolved. So easily can be brought down an organization from sex crimes that disgust most people. And whites, unlike Jews, if they see their own doing that kind of thing, are horrified and put off, and they're lulled into acquiescence or passivity. And that creates a vacuum into which the same Jews who got Mary Fagan's executioner off leap to fill. And when the Klan receded, what came back in? Why the Kikes? Denouncing the America First Committee and Charles Lindbergh and kicking them as the true head of the Aryan community out of the way and running the U.S. to their own advantage. And that's where we are today. Except it's, 80 years later, 100 years later, and we're that much farther down the line, we're that much closer to being destroyed as a nation and a people, as they've now opened the borders, and they allow all kinds of crimes like that which happened to Mary Fagan and worse to go on, and they're scarcely even reported if they're against whites, whether the commissioner is a Jew, a Mexican, or a black. They cover it up. We call them hush crimes. They don't even make the papers anymore. The Jews are happy when they happen. When blacks attack whites, they celebrate it, as with Michael Bell and the Jena 6. Shatter a white guy's skull, they don't care. What they don't like is whites standing up for themselves, who reject being attacked, don't like being raped and murdered. A white man with a noose and a truck gets more time in jail than a nigger who rapes and murders. In 2008, AmeriQua. The death of Mary Fagan led to the birth of other organizations as well, says Jones. Leo Frank was president of the Atlanta chapter of B'nai B'rith. After his death, B'nai B'rith founded the ADL to combat anti-Semitism in the U.S. The Anti-Defamation League would go on to work closely with the NAACP, which is the front group Jews set up to represent black interests, ostensibly, but actually to pursue Jewish interests. Not least by undermining the black self-help school and the black Back to Africa movement, headed by Marcus Garvey, which we talked about in Radio Astina 21 and 22, preceding this, the 23rd. Murray Friedman calls the Frank case, quote, the defining moment in the partnership between blacks and Jews, unquote, even though he later admits that the case, quote, set Jews and blacks against each other, unquote, because the Jews tried to blame crime committed by a Jew on a black. Friedman, who spent most of his adult life working for the American Jewish Committee, does his best to play down the frankly racist statements which Frank's attorneys made during the course of his trial. He also mentions the fact that the NAACP expressed resentment at what they saw as an organized effort to implicate Conley, that is the Black Knight Watchman, simply because he was black. He also mentions that the AJC's Lewis Marshall joined the board of the NAACP and served on its legal defense committee as a result of the Frank lynching. So, AJC's Lewis Marshall, who is trying to get Leo Frank off, joins the board of the NAACP and serves on its legal defense committee as a result of the Frank lynching. The aftermath of the Frank lynching brought Herbert Seligman on the board of the NAACP as well as its new Jewish director of publicity. So Marshall and Seligman joined the NAACP as a result of this Frank case. Together with Joel Spingarn, another Jew, these men, quote, campaigned relentlessly against lynching, unquote, and helped to awaken the nation's conscience. Yeah. The people who plead for their own rapist murderer to get off are awakening the nation's conscience when they're producing the newspapers or the publicity campaigns. Friedman's book, and they call us haters. Friedman's book on the Black Jewish Alliance was written, however, because another interpretation of events had arisen calling the very existence of that alliance into question. In their book, Plural But Equal, black revisionists like Harold Cruz, who I incorrectly earlier called a Jew, and David Levering Lewis, black revisionist Harold Cruz and David Levering Lewis, L-E-V-E-R-I-N-G, called the traditional narrative of black Jewish cooperation into question by accusing the Jews of promoting a hidden agenda, according to which organizations like the NAACP used frontmen like W.E.B. Du Bois to destroy any black leader not acceptable to Jewish interests. Cruz accuses Lewis Marshall in particular of using the NAACP to salve the bitter defeat he had experienced in the Leo Frank case. So they're going to use the NAACP to get back against the white Southerners who try to protect themselves from, in that case, a marauding Jew whose Jewish cohorts and co-religionists and co-tribalists try to get away with their man's crimes by blaming them on a black, if you appreciate the compounded ironies there. If that were the case, then Marshall's move to the NAACP takes on a sinister hue. Suspicions of this sort first arose during the NAACP's attack on Booker T. Washington. And Booker T. represents the black self-help school thought. Remember, three schools of thought: self-help, Back to Africa, and disintegration. The Jews support the so-called integration movement, which is really the movement to disintegrate America by mixing blacks and whites who were at that time legally, socially separate, because that was the only way the two races could get along without killing each other, or blacks killing whites and whites responding. So the black revisionist Cruz accused Lewis Marshall of using the NAACP to salve the bitter defeat he had experienced in the Leo Frank case. If that were the case, then Marshall's move to the NAACP takes on a sinister hue. Suspicions of this sort first arose during the NAACP's attack on Booker T. Washington. So the Jewish Black Front group, NAACP, attacks Booker T. Washington. They would deepen in the wake of the Frank case when the NAACP devoted even more of its energies to destroying Marcus Garvey, as we talked about last time. So, the only group Jews want representing blacks is the NAACP. And the only policy the Jews want black to follow is one of integration, forced gunpoint race mixing with whites. That is good for Jews. It's bad for blacks and it's bad for whites, but it's good for Jews. So that's what the Jews advocate, and that's what their front groups advocate. According to Cruz's reading of these events, there was no black-Jewish alliance. What went by that name was really covert Jewish revenge on the South for the role it played in the Frank lynching. The simplest way to visit revenge on the South was the plan first articulated by John Brown. Bring the war to Africa, hence the name of this article, by turning the nation's Negroes into revolutionaries. Bring the war to Africa by turning the nation's Negroes into revolutionaries. If you're not going to let us Jews get away with raping and murdering your women, then we're going to turn the niggers on you. That's what the Jews saw, believed, and did. That meant destroying any black leader who wanted to steer his people in another direction. That meant destroying Booker T. Washington because he wanted to turn the Negro into skilled craftsmen. And it meant destroying Marcus Garvey because he wanted to awaken in the American Negro a racial consciousness which was incompatible with the integration which Jewish organizations like the NAACP seemed determined to impose, as Cruz claimed, on everyone but themselves. Then, as a last note, Tom Watson died in Washington of a cerebral hemorrhage on September 26, 1922. So, within 7 years of all this, he's dead. The main white guy who led the resistance to this coordinated national Jewish campaign of lying in defense of a rapist murderer. Tom Watson died in Washington of a cerebral hemorrhage on September 26, 1922. At his funeral in Georgia, the most impressive floral arrangement was an 8-foot-high cross of red roses sent by the Klan. And that's the end of the article. And I think that will do it for our show today. We've done just about exactly 3 hours, and I'll play some music for another. I'll run through the songs we ran through before. I got about 15-20 songs here you might enjoy listening to. But that will do it for Radio Istina number 23. Again, I'm Alex Linder, and we do the show every Tuesday, 1 p.m. Central, run for 2-4 hours. You can put these on a CD. They're always available in the archive for download within 24 hours, thanks to our great archivists. And, pass around MP3s of them or pass around the URL. This is all about white education, and what you see here is really that unless we defend ourselves, the Jews will be happy to do all the talking and thinking for us, and they'll push us in the ways of racial integration, which is leads to genocide. And then we'll be just another notch on their belt as all of their holidays celebrate their destruction, their wrecking of others' nations. They're wrecking their genocidal murder of other nations is what they celebrate in all their goofy holidays. Of course, they don't tell you that. They just tell you their equivalents of Christmas. Now, Christmas is the Jews killing Jesus, and Yom Kippur and the rest are Purim, or the rest are Jews killing everybody else. They're liars, they're rapists, they're murderers, and they're the common enemy of all mankind. And you listening to this are a white man, and you belong on our team, and I hope you'll join us. Again, I'm Alex Linder. This is Radio Istina number 23, signing off on Tuesday, September 2nd, 2008, and I'll be with you again next week. Thanks for listening.
forever. If you're bad, you'll die when you die. Hearing only one true note on the one and only sound. Unzip my body, take my heart out. 'Cause I need a beat to give this to.
Keep on.